Today is June the 12th, 2021. It's 1:04 Central Standard Time. And let's see here. We've got some people in the waiting room coming into our meeting. This is our seventh meeting, The Journey. Project JFK CSI Dallas presents The Journey on the Trail of Truth in the Kennedy Assassination. I want to welcome everybody to the show. And I want to talk about a few things, and then we're going to have some special guests today. The first thing I want to talk about is coming up on, let me share the screen here real quick. I'm sure everybody has gone to our website, but I'm going to go ahead and share this screen, and we're going to talk about it real quick.
Uncle Johnny.
All right, coming up on June the 23rd of 2021. From 6 o'clock until 9 o'clock Central Standard Time. This is going to be an evening event. We're going to have special guest Dr. John Newman. Details of the event, this is coming from John Newman himself. It says, I will be offering a solo public three-hour presentation event on Wednesday the 23rd, June 6th to 9 p.m. Central. This event will preview the forthcoming work in my series on the Kennedy presidency and assassination. It will take place in a Project JFK CSI Dallas webinar. Finally, after 36 long months of collection, investigation, analysis, and reporting, Volume 4, titled Armageddon, will be coming at the end of 2021. This new book follows the ground broken in Volume 3. Armageddon will continue to overturn orthodoxy and shed more light on the shadiest trees in a dark force extending from 1940 to 1963. The format of the 23rd of June preview event will feature 2 hours of illustrated lectures with 60 minutes of live Q&A in two segments, 30 minutes at the halfway point after 1 hour and remaining 30 minutes at the end. This preview will track more than a dozen military and civilian officers that end up running everything during the Kennedy presidency, all of whom held key positions going all the way back to World War II, and most of all of whom were working to subvert Kennedy's presidency. 3 months after the publication of Armageddon, the first of the two volumes of my new work on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. will be published, JFK in Vietnam, 2017 edition, Oswald and the CIA, 2008 edition, and volumes 1 through 3 of my new series on JFK have all been necessary preparation for what is coming. The 3-year intermission between volumes 3 and 4 has yielded many surprises. I hope to see you there on June the 23rd. That is from Dr. Newman. Well, I've got this up on the screen. Definitely make sure that you click on the Eventbrite tab. Right now, there is only seating for 100, and as we get closer, if I need to buy more seating spots on Zoom, then I will do so. So please make sure, if you haven't already signed up for your ticket, make sure that you do. It is a free event again. And down here on the Events tab, click on the ProjectJFK.com, go to Events. You will find information on, this is like today's event. I will be announcing the next event. I don't have a date that I will give you today, but I will have a date posted between now and the 23rd of the month, so that way you can plan for next month's meeting. And I will also look at having another special guest speaker that we will be showcasing middle of the month of next month. And we'll give you the dates and times for that event as well. As you scroll down the events tab, you will see all of the damn, I look goofy. You will see all of the previous videos from our previous presentations and meetings. Those are free to watch. You can click on them, and then you can also go on to full screen and watch them on YouTube. If you go on YouTube, please hit that subscribe button. I know everybody says that, but please do that. That way I keep track of how many people's watching videos. When you go to the downloads and the chat log, you will see that there is a download button for every text document of all of our chat logs during the previous presentations, just like there will be one for today that will be posted. I added a new section within the last 2 weeks since we met, and this is downloads MP3 of the Journey meetings. You can download the video or the audio presentations from the videos from up above, and you can download these, put them on your phone, MP3 player, some headphones have SD cards, you can download it, put it on that, and then take it jogging or walking or going someplace else in case you want to hear that. And if you know of anybody that hasn't attended our videos, and meetings, they can watch the videos or listen to just the audio. So please share that with people and let them know that it's on the website. As we go along, I keep adding new things, so that way try to keep more people interacted into our website. I've got a few more people to admit to our meeting here. Let me click on that.
Can I say something? Can I interject for a sec? Because all that modern stuff, is everyone able to cope with it?
What's that now?
Is anyone above 60 years old actually able to cope with all that technology as such?
Well, I've made it so user-friendly that by just going onto the website and hitting the little play button, or by just going down and hitting the download button, it will automatically bring up a window so they can listen to it. So hopefully, if anybody has questions, maybe I'll put a little dialogue on here, you know, a how-to step presentation on how to do this.
But, I think you should put a different face to many faces of David Knight. So each one should have a special face. And that's so like whatever the program was, see all these different faces of David Knight?
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be part of the next to Boris glossary.
Well, definitely, that's a hell of an idea. we'll make it a picture deal in Word as well. We did have a special guest speaker at our last event. If anybody has not already seen the video presentation, Craig Chacon came on and gave us a lot of great information about his work and also his book and his schematics that he had done. So let me click stop share here and see if I can get this on the screen. Oh, no, it's not going to work. Okay. Let me go ahead and just do another share screen here real quick. And I'll show you what I've got here. Okay. There is a book that he has written called Master List of Witnesses to the Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Can everybody see this? Let's see. Let me change the page here.
Okay. By the way, is Casey that short, or is he just in a small chair?
He's just in a small chair. We don't have him in the high chair today, ladies and gentlemen.
I cannot believe I'm on TV right now, and people are still yelling. Am I standing up or am I short? I'm short, but I am sitting down on a low chair.
Well, if you go to our website, click on the More tab and see affiliated websites, you'll come to Craig Chacon's website at craigchacon.wordpress.com. There's a whole bunch of stuff on the deal, but you can click on it from our website to his. It's a whole lot easier to get there. But this is the book that I'm holding here in my hands. It's 8.5 by 11, 150 pages. It's the preface, introduction list of acronyms and abbreviations, 96-page list of witnesses, epilogue, appendix, a study of eyewitness groupings, extended sources, thoroughly annotated with analysis and points of contention, thoroughly sourced, utilizing the recorded groups of the Warren Commission, FBI, Secret Service, presidential libraries, and the Dallas Municipal Archives and Records, current and established private. Now, let me show you a couple pages from his book. I want to show you. I did this with my Cam Scan app, so I could show you today. But let me go ahead and pull this up. All right. What I like about what he did here is. Okay. When you look at, James Featherston, Marie Feschner, it shows exactly the number off to the side, like this says 328, or down here for Ronald B. Fisher, 52. It shows you on his schematic map where that person is located at. And then it tells you, auditor of the Dallas County DCRB, Shows you where they were located at. Southwest corner of Elm, Houston with Edwards. It has a quote over here onto the side. There's notes as well. And then if you go on to, like, let's just say Betty Alice Foster. She's number 147 on the map. It gives you the she's on the fourth floor of the TSBD with Holly's. It gives you information. And then if you go over here, there's actually in the notes section, it's got actually part of the testimony that was given. These are this is an incredible book for anybody that wants to know where the witnesses are. What Craig's work is based on witnesses, where they were in Dealey Plaza at that time. And also, go ahead and take a look at that, Casey. It's a companion piece to his, maps. I've got a tube here. It's 2 foot by 3 foot, so it comes in a mailer. It is an excellent work, and the book is just the best thing that I've seen as far as list of witnesses, where they're located at, to help out with research. Again, you can go to our website, click on Craig's, and there's a contact for his email. So I know he's got a little issue with his store right now as far as how to purchase the map and the book. I'm working on him with that as quickly as we can get it together to where people can purchase this. And then I think he is doing PayPal plus the price of the items and then the shipping cost, wherever it's going to be shipped to, whether it's here in the United States or if it's overseas. Depending on what the shipping cost is, obviously he's going to charge that to the total price of the book and the map. I suggest if anybody wants it, make sure that you get the map and the book because you can't have one without the other. And I was really happy to have him on our show last time and 2 weeks ago to come in and tell us about his work. So I will be plugging his work over the next few shows. And just as soon as I can, I don't want to put up a really high-def image of his schematics, but I know he has the Dealey Plaza one, and then he also sent me a Xerox copy of his work that was done in the Oak Cliff area at the Tippett murder scene. So I want to say that, I will show you a low-resolution still image of those two items probably at the next meeting. I'll have time to get that done. Actually, it won't be the next meeting. That's John Newman, so it'll be next month you'll see that. You can also go onto his website and see a low-res scan of what it looks like. But I got to tell you, it puts it in black and white, 2 foot by 3 foot. You're able to see everything. The book helps you know exactly what number is what. I suggest anybody that hasn't already gotten it or maybe had the 1991 version, the new updated map that was done back about 10 or 11 years ago, it definitely looks a lot it's more precise, and he has things that he changed, that is correct, and he spent a lot of time fixing that. So I think anybody that, wants to support fellow researchers and fellow works of the JFK research, definitely he's one of the guys we want to support. So, again, if anybody has any questions, they'll be in the chat log. And, again, Craig Chacon, want to thank him again for that. Let's see if there's anything else. By the way, Brian Edwards is not going to be joining us today. He had some personal engagement that he had to take care of. But me and Casey are here this week. And our two special guests we're going to have on that I've already set time aside for is Larry Staff, so he can tell us about what is going on in his world of lawyering. And also, Bill Simpage asked for some time, so we're going to get him on here, too, as well. So with that, I'm going to shut the hell up, and I'm going to give it over to Larry and let him talk for a little bit. Go ahead, Larry.
Tell us
what's going on that's new.
So I want to first acknowledge some of the members of our, I guess what we informally call ourselves is In Our Lifetime Committee. Some of the members are on this call today, Patrick McCarthy, Andrew Illar, and Bill Simpage. I think Mark Adamowicz is also going to be joining. So I just wanted to acknowledge their presence and thank them for their participation in our effort. The thing we're working on now is a letter to President Biden. President Biden has, over the past couple months, revoked and rescinded a number of executive orders and actions that former President Trump had issued. And so the letter that we're drafting to President Biden, which we're going to have multiple signatories on it, is to ask him directly to revoke the 2018 certification that President Trump signed on April 26th of 2018 that certified the postponement for three more years of the JFK records, and ask him to immediately release, order all the records to be released. I doubt, even if he does the revocation of the order, I doubt that he's going to actually order CIA to release everything in FBI, but at least it will put it back on the front burner that this has to be done. We are essentially drafting a legal memo, which is the memo that should have been drafted in 2018, that authorized the president to extend or postpone the release of the records three more years. That was a memo drafted in the Office of Legal Counsel. It was essentially a memo designed to support the decision that was made before the memo was written. And so what we're drafting, and Andrew Iller and Adam Adamowicz are working on the first draft of that, and that's going to be the legal memo that explains why that decision was incorrect and why the records should be released. At the very least, we're going to ask for the document-by-document explanation as to why each document should be continue to be postponed, which they, no one has done before publicly, and it's required under the law to do that. So we are aiming to send that letter to the president before the end of the month. That's the aspirational goal, because we have some drafting to do. The letter is almost finished, but the memo is the part that's going to take a little time. And we're going to do like we did with Mark Day's letter, have a number of people that on both sides of the issue, as well as bipartisan representatives, sign the letter. And then once that gets sent, we will then turn back to Congress. Congress has been somewhat involved the last couple of weeks on the infrastructure bill, and they'll be also focusing on the budget. So we're going to send another letter with, besides just me, we're going to basically put together a list of constituents to sign the letter to make it clear to Congress that this is just more than Larry Schnapp asking them to hold oversight hearings, but a whole group of people that are interested, both prominent people and constituents. So that's the most immediate steps that we're going to be doing. Also going to be submitting FOIA requests to CIA, FBI, and the State Department asking for the underlying documents that were exchanged between them and NARA in 2018 and 2017, requesting the basis for the postponements. We doubt that that will, they're probably going to assert some sort of privilege or some exemption of the FOIA, but we want to at least put it on the record in case we have a lawsuit down the road. I haven't had a chance to look at this, but apparently there was a decision, maybe Bill knows about it, in the Ninth Circuit. Anthony Bothwell's case, I guess, was denied in the Ninth Circuit, but it was asking a release of some records for a CIA person, but I haven't had a chance to look at it, so Bill might know a little bit more about that.
No, sorry, Larry. News to me.
Oh, okay.
Can I ask you a question? Really
yes.
Quick. In all your letter writing, et cetera, do you actually make mention about the fact that less than half of the stuff has actually been released, and why the other stuff hasn't been released?
Yeah, we've used the data that we have a legal memorandum attached to each of the letters, and that discusses Rex's analysis, as well as the fact that the website is down now. The NARA website on the JFK collection is down, and only 52% of the records that are supposedly in the collection are available, listed. And we also go into detail about the various records that have not been released, as well as the church committee records. So yeah, we've created a record, a paper trail, at least to document what's missing. To the extent that we know that, you know, it's hard to say if something is not in the collection, it's hard to say that, you know, it's out there. But for whatever we know of, based on Rex's analysis.
Let me just interject you, and that also goes against what Rex is saying, or Joe Bax knows partially about this, because I've now been scanning Malcolm Blunt's material in for 2.5 years, and the amount of documentation that is not online, but yet, due to the fact that I've got the riff sheets, and either it's just a riff sheet, or it has a certain amount of pages, sometimes they're complete, sometimes they're incomplete, but the amount of the fact that the amount in that collection from Blunt of that is not available online is huge. I mean, I thought it was 10 or 20%, but it's much bigger. So these riff sheets are handy for finding documents that you know what it contains, but there's no, there, that is then the trace for it. And you can basically take that riff, send it to Nara and say, I've got this riff number. There's no trace of it online. I know what it's about because that's what it says on the riff. Can you send me this document, or can I buy it, or whatever? And there's just loads of that. And that also goes into conjunction with what Joe Back said and what you're just saying and so forth. As a matter of fact, I think it's a real dirty mess. Not just for that they were withholding all the stuff, but the fact that it's just been reclassified or it just disappeared or whatever the reason may be as such. And that's just a massive chunk of material. But in about 3-4 months when I release it all, people can see for themselves how much there is actually in these folders of documentation that you can look at that's completely absent on the net anywhere, basically.
Yeah, the statute calls those identification aids, and we are actually referencing that in the legal memo we're preparing for the president.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, but if you have any further information, you know, I mean, we know if you have information that is beyond what Rex has said or that Jeff Morley has said, then let me know, because we can add it.
But it's just a ton, you know. It's just spread over, I don't know, 150 folders per subject and blah blah blah. And it's just, and the thing is also, I didn't start doing this until about a year ago, when I started pumping the riff numbers in, because before that, it was just blind scanning everything in that Malcolm gave me as such. And yet now I'm like, no, I'm going to go through the riff numbers first, because what's the point in scanning all this stuff in when it's already at Mary Farrell? So,
yeah, well, the problem is the collection is not available online right now, down for quote unquote maintenance. And the spreadsheet that Nara has prepared, I forgot if it only contains 52% or only 48%, but roughly half of the documents supposedly in the collection are not listed on that spreadsheet. And none of them are available online at this point, because the collection is available.
And Mary Farrell only has 10 or 15% of all the documents. So what Malcolm's doing is critical.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's going to give you a really good insight as to what's around. And in all honesty, the so-called missing documents, they're all over. Although I think church committee material and its importance of certain documents is probably number one. But there are missing documents on any law enforcement agency or any segment parcel of this.
And the church committee is a whole separate problem, because congressional records have their own rules. So Congress is not subject to the FOIA laws, and unless the congressional records were included or ascended to the collection, we have to actually go to Congress and get the clerk to agree to declassify those records. So it's a whole nother. So that's why a lot of the church committee, some of the testimony, and you know, Jim Johnston, who has been speaking to us, our group, you know, he kind of helped us understand. He wrote the CIA portion of Book 5 of the Church Committee. That's the book that was issued by the Hart Schweikert. So he, and so there are documents that or testimony that he cites to that have not been released. So he was actually very helpful in helping us understand the process that went on with Church Commission. It was, as you would expect, you know, they had a time clock on them. And so it was a question of if they insisted on all the documents, they're going to get none. So they compromised with CIA to get some. Or, you know, I don't know what the amount was. But so there's still documents. And who knows, I don't know if those documents were given, were identified under ARC's process. So, you know, each agency had to certify that they complied with the JFK Records Act.
Well, they didn't.
I mean, what's the consequences? I mean, you know, there were people that lied, and look what happened to the Secret Service.
Yeah.
You know, they destroyed records after they were asked for them, and nothing happened to them. So, you know, if the CIA says, yeah, we're certifying, we're giving you everything we have, and if they haven't, what's the consequences?
Yeah, I agree. We've just been lucky because Malcolm basically visited the archives over the period of time that many times, that he basically managed to take a lot of stuff out there that has been reclassified as such, you know, and all that stuff's going to be available around the anniversary. I think I'm going to release it just before the anniversary because I need to organize a few things. I'm intending to get it, to get like phase one, sorted out because I was at Malcolm's 2 weeks ago. And I picked up another, I don't know, 10, 12 bags. And he surprised me a bit because I thought, like, oh, I've got half a dozen bags left. I'm going to pick them up, and that's it. And the next thing I know, some of these drawers that I knew for a fact that were empty have refilled themselves somehow. And when I asked him, I'm like, what's all this stuff in here? This is another dozen bags of stuff. And he goes, oh, I don't know. And I'm like, yeah, I bet you don't know. So I just got another wagon load, picked it up and took it with me. There's some really good stuff in there. I'm going to paste a really cool document. And this is one thing I'm going to share. Let me just paste this in.
Yeah, I'll just, while you're doing that, I think what happens is Bush Jr., W., his executive order tightened up the rules for classification or made them more liberal. So it's possible that records that were not classified when Clinton was president could have been reclassified under the executive order that President Bush issued. I don't know. I'm speculating. But that could be...
My understanding, Larry, is they simply reclassified a lot of the documents after the first release in the early 90s because they became unglued by how much was actually getting out there without being vetted by the CIA.
Yeah, but I think they could also rely on the Bush executive order to justify.
Yeah, maybe. All I know is they did it, and it was outrageous.
This document is an FSA report on Charles Rogers, who was part of the motorcade. And if you click on the link, let me just tell it to everyone. He was one of the Dallas Police PD motorcycle policemen riding alongside Kennedy's car in the motorcade. And when the shots were fired, he heard a clanging noise on the fender of his bike. He looked down and saw a copper jacketed .45 caliber slug roll off into the street.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought this was quite a good whopper.
Does it have a RIF number?
No, I don't have the RIF. No, but, or do I?
You don't know whether this is part of the collection or not.
This is part of the, this is from the HSCA. It's an outside contact report from, was it 78? Something like that, yeah. 11th of August, 1978.
Yeah, but see, here, it does say it's JFK collection. Okay. Because again, if this is a congressional record, in theory, you know, they could have kept it and not released it.
That's another thing I'd like to mention, make mention of. I don't know if everybody probably knows about this, but the Library of Congress had a copy of every document from the JFK collection. And then, you know where they're based? Those documents? They were in Building 7.
Building 7?
Yes. The whole Library of Congress material was in
Building 7. You say Building 7, the World Trade Center?
Yes. So when that went down, the entire collection went down. A copy of every damn document. Yeah. So it's gone. So that's what Malcolm told me. So I was quite surprised by that. But he said the Library of Congress has a copy of each document that's been created. And they stored them in the WTC-7. Yeah. So,
holy cow.
You know, when you saw that plane come in and all those documents dangling down and all that?
Yeah, but
the solution was right in the air, dangling about, you know, coming 80 floors down.
Seven was the one that had the police security group, and that one was from the tanks got caught on fire. That was a fuel related, not from the planes, but that was fuel related from what was going on. That one wasn't hit, but it did go down because of a fire, and the whole police security was affected.
Well, I didn't know that Library of Congress had a copy of each document that was around, so I was quite surprised about that. But yeah, that's just a
Malcolm told you. So, do we have any other verification that that's where the Library of Congress stored these materials?
I think I've got some kind of a document. Let me just have a quick look. I might just have something on this.
It's kind of odd that it would be stored in New York. I just, you know, my BS detector is...
HSCA records that WT7, Kennedy assassination, 34 boxes of HSCA material held at World Trade Center. And it also, this is one page only, but it mentions three boxes in there. So this is a bigger document. This is one of the setbacks from Malcolm's collection. There are, in many cases, incomplete documents. So one, page two is missing, this, that, and the other. It's just that happens fairly often that the actual documents aren't complete. And I don't know what the reason for that is. Maybe it wasn't interesting to Malcolm. There was only one page that he thought that would be interesting.
So,
it just wasn't there.
What's the reading? Did Malcolm have a note saying, or is there some official document saying this is where they were stored? What are you reading from saying that it was stored in Building 7?
Okay, let me tell you.
I don't mean to be grilling you. I'm just trying to understand.
No, you are. No need to skirt around the issue. I will, I'll tell you what, I'll paste these links in about 2 minutes.
Okay.
And then
thank you. That's great.
Click on them, and then
because that's important to run down to see. You know, it's just odd that the Library of Congress would be storing things in New York. I'm speaking out of ignorance. I don't know if that's a practice or not.
Oh well, I speak out of ignorance all the time, so it's no big deal.
I'm actually going to check the Library of Congress website and see if they have anything interesting to say about this.
So now there's two documents already. Do I have something more? No. Okay. Fine. I find it really important that the push is for, you know, I remember what, 3-4 years ago, everybody said, oh, we're missing this, we're missing that, this, that, and the other. But nobody knew, like, there's only half of it is actually available as such. And, you know, that needs to come out. But to the wider audience, instead of, hold on a minute, you signed this act in what, 92? 30 years later, we got half. That's it. You know? And I think as a argument to get this stuff online and all that, I think that's one of the strongest arguments to put forward as such, to say, well, what's the point of having this act and you only basically throw in half of the material as such? And the funny thing is that from the stuff that I've been scanning in, most of the CIA stuff is already online with Mary Farrell. Anything on the Cubans and all the crypto stuff and anything I got my hands on, if I'm lucky, maybe 10% of Malcolm's documents weren't online. The other 90% They were all there. Of all the documents that where I find like they're online and so forth, is the agency and the whole Cuban thing. Is there's loads, tons of it at Mary Farrell mostly, and sometimes
well, a lot of the EF, the Cuban, none of the Kennedy tapes, the Oval Office tapes involving Cuba in '63, are publicly available. Bobby took those, and any and a lot of documents related to that are also in the Robert F. Kennedy collection. So, and then of course the CIA, you'll see that there was instructions to make as little, put as little in writing as possible. The FBI is the one that actually pushed back heavily against the ARB. They had to go to the White House a couple of times to resolve disputes. The FBI really pushed back.
Of course, they did, because they looked like the guilty party. That's why.
Well, they were using the investigation exemption, but I'm just saying that the FBI is the one that really pushed back. The CIA allegedly was more cooperative than the FBI, but they cooperate of records that existed as opposed to records that never existed, because they didn't put the right thing down. Anyway, I'm finished with my summary of what's going on. So expect we're aiming to get the letter to the president by the end of the month.
Oh, great.
So what we're going to do is in next we hope to get the letter finalized next week, and then the week after we'll be trying to solicit signatures from, you know, prominent historians and other people to sort of show him, and we're going to try to get some of the his former colleagues of the Senate as well. You know, this is aspirational, but we want to get as many. We want to show this is bipartisan. That it has no, it's all about the records, compliance, doesn't do anything about theories of the assassination. It's all about, and we're tying this together with the whole problem of declassification, that if you can't get the Kennedy assassination, is sort of like a bellwether, as we call it in the law, when you have a class action, you pick a couple of individuals to represent the whole class. So this is like the flashing red light. If you can't get this one solved, then how are you going to deal with all the other problems with declassification? Patrick or Bill, you have anything that you want to add?
No, I'm good. I'm just getting ready for my presentation.
Okay.
When I'm done.
Okay, I'm done.
No, so I'm fine with it.
For the viewers, really quick before Bill kicks off, I posted both links to these documents in the chat box.
Good, thank you.
Okay, well, let's see here. So I get my video to come back on. I know you can hear me. Damn technology. Okay, well, thank you, Larry. I appreciate the update on that. I think we all do. And great information back and forth. Son of a bitch.
This is being recorded, right?
Yeah, it's being recorded, all right. There we go. Okay. Yeah, we're going to have Bill Simovich come up next. And he is going to be, he sent me an email, so we're going to show some links that, just like we did at the last meeting. And let me make sure I can highlight. Yes, I can. Okay, great. Bill, go ahead and take it away, and we'll start with your presentation you've got.
Okay. Could you put I sent you three links for posting. Do you see those three links? They're called
They're all in
publish
bold,
number
right?
one.
Publish yep. number one. Let me look here. Yep.
Yeah, why don't you put – I only want to put up three links. I want to focus on the narrative. But if you could put publish number one while I talk, I think that will help with the import.
Okay, well, give me just a quick sec.
Okay.
Publish number one. The newspaper, right?
That's it.
Okay, let me pull this up. Okay, we got it up on the screen.
That's great. I want to kind of use that as the background for the first part of my talk. And I've got two more like it. You'll see them down in what I sent you, number two and number three. I'll ask for them when we get there.
Okay.
But what I wanted to focus on is the importance of using news media for research in particular, because this story about this colonel being a spy in Russia is critical because I believe, in fact, I know that he was the man in charge of a defector program that ended in 1960 when a defector named Vladimir Sloboda blew the whistle on it after he defected in August of 1960 and ended a whole round of 12 defections, of which Oswald was one of them. We can't yet prove that Oswald was part of this program, but as we go through my presentation, I think you'll see how strong the links are, if nothing else. Another thing I want to focus on in starting is people may remember that I did a presentation about the Fort Worth Star-Telegram reporter Kent Biffle a little while ago. Biffle interviewed Marguerite Oswald a lot in the 59-60 period in particular, and it got to the point where her relationship with the paper became so strong that they were phone calls were being sent to from that were supposed to go to Marguerite would go to a Fort Worth Star-Telegram employee. Her mail went to the house. There's a very strange relationship. I've learned a little bit more about it, which I think is a good preamble. And it's important to remember that the entire Dallas-Fort Worth region was dependent on the aerospace and military. Amon G. Carter, Sr., founded the radio station WBAP in 1922 and then became publisher of the Star-Telegram in 1923. Peter Dale Scott characterizes Amon Carter, Sr. and his son as the pillars of the Air Force industrial complex. And it's been said that no other individual in no other city in the United States are so inexplicably entwined with each other as Amon Carter and Fort Worth. One book refers to Amon Sr.'s impact on Fort Worth as basically making it a one-man city. He helped get Carswell Air Force Base set up, which is a pillar in the city, of course, and where JFK flew out to land in Love Field that day on November 22nd. Now, here's the Marguerite connection. And it's amusing to point out that Amon Carter was such an institution that Lee Oswald in 1949 actually went to Camp Amon Carter Summer Camp, a 340-acre facility outside of Fort Worth sponsored by the YMCA. She testified to the Warren Commission, Marguerite did, that as a practical nurse, she took care of the children of Amon Carter Jr. in his home. Now, Amon Carter Jr. is a character in his own right. He was held as a POW by the Germans and risked his life in espionage and sending contraband in the mail that could have got him killed. He did this for 40 years, continuing to support his friends in Poland by smuggling contraband, clothing, necessities, luxury items, money, until his death in 1982. And what's so interesting to me about all this is a couple things. Is one, not only did Marguerite work for this guy, but she got fired by the family 11 days before the assassination. I just found this out yesterday, which it points to me about the importance of continued research. She was very upset about the family. In fact, she went so far as to write the FBI after the Warren Commission was done and accused Mrs. Carter of playing a role in the assassination. And the Fort Worth Star-Telegram was all over the assassination story, of course. But what's so curious to me is after the HSCA came out with its findings on conspiracy, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram actually backed up people like Marguerite and said, we really need to get to the bottom of this case. We're convinced there was a conspiracy. And that absolutely stunned me. I don't know another newspaper in the United States that actually switched its position from anti to pro, multiple gunmen.
So something very dramatic was going on. And something very dramatic was going on with Marguerite, because by the time Thanksgiving 62 rolled around, none of the sons in the family would talk to her anymore. And they they interacted with her for a couple of days after the assassination, and they cut her off for the rest of their lives. And I think it was because they blamed her for not taking care of Lee when they took away his honorable discharge and made it a undesirable discharge. I think there was real resentment there in the whole family about that. I can't prove that, but that's where the evidence is taking me as I speak. So now here's the bombshell. The Marguerite stuff to me is absolutely fascinating. And anybody who has good stuff on Marguerite, please send me an email, because I'm on a hot streak here. But here's the real stuff. It comes back to this fella, Colonel Theodore Hoffman, who the turncoat, military defector, charges area colonel with being U.S. spy in Russia. As far as I can see, the guy who came up with the term turncoat and made it popular about these military defectors was none other than Marguerite's pal, Kent Biffle, who wrote all the stories about Oswald when he defected and got him published in the Fort Worth papers. Now, I want to do maybe 3 minutes of history here. And the reason I want to do this history as background to Theodore Hoffman is because I think this illustrates just how impacted the U.S. was by, you know, all these millions of Americans attaining all these superpowers, if you will, by, you know, being military personnel during World War II, you know, one of the great conflicts of all time. And what the impact is on a society after an event like that. I can only imagine what it was like in Europe and Asia. Now, there's this anti-Stalinist professor. I'm going to not try to drop a lot of names. This guy's name's not terribly important, but it's interesting. His name was Nicholas Popp. And as the Soviets were closing in on Berlin in 45, he'd been evacuated to Czechoslovakia. When he got there, he encountered a guy that I learned about, of all people, from George de Morenschel, who used to sing his praises and infuriate people who knew who he was. This fellow encountered General Vlasov. Vlasov had been captured by the Germans during World War II, and he was forced basically to organize an army for him. The Vlasov army was a brainchild of Heinrich Himmler, and it consisted of a mix of Soviet prisoners of war faced with the choice of joining or starving to death, and volunteers motivated by hating the Soviet regime or, you know, opportunism. They fought briefly as a unit for the Nazis, but these people, you know, were not only who worked for Vlasov, had actually been part of, in some cases, SS extermination units. Pop claimed he stayed, the professor that I started with, claimed he stayed away from General Vlasov, but he clearly sympathized with him. Now, wrap your mind around this. At the end of the war, about 5.5 million Soviet citizens lived in Germany. Most of them were prisoners or forced laborers. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine what these countries have gone through? Of this large number, tens of thousands had collaborated with the Nazis, among them Vlasov and his people. And these people, not a few of them, were considered war criminals. Tens of thousands of these people could not safely go home. And so what the Americans realized was that the Soviet non-returners might be a valuable political resource. I think you see where I'm going here. The use of Soviet displaced persons to fill in the gaps of our current intelligence, as the State Department put it, became a desirable strategy. And Nicholas Popp, this professor who escaped and met Vlasov, was a star in this prospect, in this respect. And so where I'm going with this is a program got set up at Harvard, and it was a training program for the people who were going to run the Allied occupation of Germany. This fellow's name, this hopefully the last name I'll drop in a hurry, a guy named Talcott Parsons became part of the staff, and he was a pragmatic Cold War liberal kind of guy. He knew that Harvard's Russian Research Center was closely integrated with governmental intelligence. And this Russian Research Center, for those of you who know the Oswald backstory, is important because Oswald, when he got to Moscow, he met with the State Department attaché, and he came from this Russian Research Center at Harvard. And he had been previous CIA, and his name was Richard Snyder. And the first person who interviewed him was another person from that same area of Harvard and, you know, on the Russian research side. And that was Priscilla McMillan Johnson, Priscilla Johnson McMillan. And both of these people are two of what I call the Oswald legend makers in my book on the subject. So this is all new stuff I've discovered just in the last couple of weeks, and it's blown me away because this fella Parsons, who's setting up this research center, he meets with Vlasov's people, and he meets with Theodore Hoffman. Hoffman is a lieutenant colonel, and he's part of the whole work to set up this integration with this Allied occupation of Germany. So I'm going to leave that right there for now. But and I'm going to kick it up to August of 1960. Now, at this point, Oswald defected about 9 months ago. There's been a group of about 12 people that have been, you know, entering from various agencies over the last 12 to 18 months. But Sloboda's the last of this group, and here's the reason why. And that the newspaper article is all about what Sloboda's revelation. When Sloboda defects on the 2nd of August, he defects in East Berlin, and he asks for asylum. And then he goes on Moscow TV at the end, right around the end of the month here, and this is what the newspaper story is about. He states that there's an attaché of the American embassy in Moscow. And that's Hoffman. That's the current Colonel Theodore Hoffman. An attaché of the American embassy in Moscow has helped the U.S. get spies into the Soviet Union disguised as tourists, delegates, and diplomats. And in fact, that's exactly how Oswald got in. He got in as a tourist. The embassy said that this attaché was, in fact, Colonel Theodore Hoffman, now in West Germany. Now, if you could shift the screen for a minute, David, go to Publish number two.
Okay, number two.
Yeah, tell me when that's up.
Give me just a second.
Yeah.
Publish number two.
It's a story in Izvestia, the Soviet newspaper.
Okay, hold on. Is that off the Mary Farrell Foundation website?
Let me take a peek. It should be.
Okay. This should be it. Let's make sure.
It says total espionage?
Yep. Got it. That's it.
Okay. Total espionage has become official policy of the American government. This is what Sloboda had to say. And Izvestia printed this whole thing. Now, I love monitoring the news media, and I find the way this story was handled just fascinating. The New York Times did break it. Almost nobody else broke it. One of the few exceptions that I've been able to find is this enormous story in this little newspaper in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. And the reason why is because Hoffman's a local boy. And you notice there's no author that I can find to the story. There's no AP, UPI, anything like that. This is all local work. I think they did it from the New York Times and the Izvestia story and interviews. But it's fascinating.
Who's the author?
This story got sat on. And it should have surfaced, you know, big time after the assassination, and it didn't. This is why I'm so excited about it. I really think there's a lot of good stuff here. Colonel Theodore Hoffman.
Was this testimony?
Excuse me?
Was this testimony?
No. None of this is testimony. This is news articles.
Huh.
You know? It's absolutely fascinating. And you can find various bits in documents, which is what I've done here. I'm not putting up all the posts because it just takes too long, but I can tell you I'm pulling all these right off Mary Farrell, and I can post the whole thing or send the whole thing, what I've got, to anybody who wants to see it. Here's what Sloboda says in this article. He says that Hoffman was the Army attaché in Moscow from May 59, that's 4 months before Oswald's arrival, maybe five, to May 61. Hoffman said that what Sloboda did by blowing this open, as well as other people, Hoffman told the CIA his work was totally compromised during this era. And this article here in Asbestia says, quote Sloboda, and this is the killer, you guys. Units of the Army, Air Force, and Naval Intelligence Services of the United States, who have departments in all big West German cities, are operating in West Germany under the control of the Central Intelligence Agency. The biggest units of the Army Intelligence Services of the United States in West Germany are Group 513. And this is really important because, you know, Hoffman ran 513. And this is where Sloboda served. And one other one. The 513 Intelligence Service, for instance, is now more than 2,000 strong. So what Hoffman's doing is he's going back and forth from being the Army attaché at the American Embassy in Moscow, and he's going back to West Germany where he's running this whole operation that involves defectors like Sloboda. Sloboda goes on to say, this guy's a double agent at this point. You know, he was like a young kid who was a displaced person in 1952, you know, with no shoes, I think. He walked over to the American side. And he went to Fort Bragg, he got trained, he got military education, this and that. And then about 154 members of this 513th got arrested by East German authorities for espionage. I mean, now, can you imagine that? Over 150 Americans who are spooks being arrested by the East Germans. You'd think this would be the biggest story on the planet. But it's totally shut up. Now, Sloboda was not one of them, but he was shook. And that's when he defects about two, three months later. Now, what's going on here? And this, you know, if you're like me, you know, and was a kid during this period, you'd be reading the sports page, which is how I got into this kind of thing. And they're saying, well, we don't know if there's going to be a baseball season by the end of the year because there might be World War III. You know, and people like Curtis LeMay are encouraging this kind of talk. This is the kind of atmosphere that I grew up in. And what Sloboda says is intensive preparations for a new war are now going on at units of the U.S. Intelligence Service and at the headquarters of the United States Army formations in Europe. In particular, they're smuggling an increasing number of agents into the East Germany, the Soviet Union, and other socialist countries to collect intelligence information on vital establishments in these countries. Group 513 has topographical maps of the USSR, Poland. And remember, you know, Minsk is right in the sweet spot there. You know, it used to be Poland, and then it became, you know, Byelorussia, which is now Belarus. Czechoslovakia, and other countries on which the targets for future bombings are marked. We're talking, you know, World War III or a ground war, you know, between Western and Eastern Europe. And, you know, which was a fear right up till 89 when, you know, the Soviet Union in 91 when Berlin Wall fell and then the Soviet Union collapsed. I know that one of the purposes of U-2 flights over the territory of the Soviet Union is to collect data for these maps. And, of course, what did Oswald work on, the U-2? What did he talk about, you know, when he got to the Soviet Union? He said, I know stuff that you guys might be interested in. He never quite crossed the line and said, I'm going to give it to you, but he's saying, I know stuff. And Colonel Thomas Hoffman, when he's interviewed in that paper, if you want to go back to that paper for just a minute, he tells the paper that he was surprised by the spy charge. I mean, that's the only thing he could say, because this is a BFD. This is a big effing deal. I was surprised. So the headline again, turncoat charges area colonel with being spy in Russia, which he absolutely was by his own admission. The HSCA defector study, like the paper that came out. Oh yeah, this is the other thing. Right after this happened, this is when, somebody, some people say it's Hugh Cummings. I've seen other people say that it was actually Otto Atepka, put the list of 12 defectors out that went to the CIA. It's after this event that the CIA starts analyzing these 12 defectors. And this is the time when Oswald's actually given a 201 number by the CIA. And then the HSCA looked at 12 cases again, which resembled Oswald even more in another aspect, going back 4 years. But the only one that was after Sloboda was a woman who was not military. In terms of the military defectors, this is the last of the military defector groups. And because Hoffman's program's blown. There's a fellow named Bruce Davis within this 12. He went through East Berlin, and after a month, he's in the USSR. There's a guy named Joe Dukanis. And Joe went from West Germany to Czechoslovakia and then the USSR. Oswald got into a slightly different route. He went from Finland. He may have flown from Germany. We don't quite know, but we think he may have flown from Germany to Finland and then the USSR. Or maybe Sweden. But again, it was a circuitous route. The only question is, in my mind, is not whether or not there was a military defection program that Hoffman was running, because it's documented. And I can send you the links. The only question is, was Oswald part of that? And my theory, at a minimum, is we know that Hoffman's leading a big wing of military intelligence cooperation that's being coordinated by the CIA through his work in both Moscow and West Berlin. Most of the key ones are Army Intelligence Link, their Navy, Air Force as well. Oswald and Robert Webster were linked in the same operation with Air Force involvement. Webster was very direct. Oswald was monitored by Max Clark, who was working in industrial security and had OSI links when he came home. And when you get to the question of how did Oswald go to, the Soviet Union in the first place, it's my thinking, along with other people, is that he worked with ONI in 58 when he was in the Navy. And ONI was probably the lead player. And State Department, with people like Richard Snyder, were backing this play in some way. And CIA and the Marines played some kind of small roles. Hoffman certainly seems to have had a role in this whole operation. How could he not know about Oswald? He was the army attaché in Moscow at the very moment that Richard Snyder is interviewing. So he knew who Oswald was. The only question was he helping lead him? Now, there's another, if you get into this a little bit deeper, you can't read it here, but Hoffman had a really interesting middle name. These people are high German. His full name was Theodor Frelinghuysen Hoffman. He was a cryptolinguist. He was the chief of the language department in West Point in the 1940s. The founder of the Allied occupation government, the Alliierte Besatzung Deutschland in Germany, the commander of the United States Army Counterintelligence School at Fort Hollaberg in 1950, and in 1951, he was the chief of the Nike missile SAM site in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This is a powerful operative, a very powerful operative, And you could have fun with this and try to figure out, was somebody in the CIA trying to compromise him? He had a lot of power over CIA counter-penetration powers, or he was working totally in league with them, without a question. That could also be possible. If you look in the 1969 official register, I put this up, but it's hard to read. Hoffman, by that point, or at least at one point in his career, he's deputy commander of the United States Army International Technology Centers under the U.S. Army Research, Development, and Engineering Command. This would indicate that Hoffman oversaw the collection of all captured foreign weapons and tactical technologies. According to the U.S. Army's own publications, these international technology centers are typically based in foreign embassies. And there's another item we found, that between 61 and 64, Hoffman was a senior asset to the U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command. This would imply he had access to signals intelligence and mail interception programs run by the Army Security Agency. In terms of messages being sent from military bases to military assets, or enemy assets. Think about Oswald subscribing to communist publications while he's in Japan, you know, that kind of thing. And you could code messages inside of publications. So the opportunities for spy activity here are just, you know, myriad. And then I even found one article that in 62, he's out there yakking with people in the Kiwanis Club, you know. Now, why is he talking? You know, is he letting slip little bits of information to people that want to know in a kind of a safe setting? That article says, in any case, that he was a director of the Russian Language Department at West Point and was the first commandant of the Russian Area Language School at Oppergummerow in Germany. This guy is multifaceted like David Morales. You know, he's got superpowers of more than one kind. He's a cryptolinguist. He understands all these different languages. He understands these technologies. He's running defectors. I mean, this is a Renaissance man, if you will. You know, it's not an accident that he's a colonel at a very young age. A lot of these guys, if they make colonel, they make colonel when they're retired, basically. They're called bird colonels, and they're like a lieutenant colonel. So anyway, to wrap up, we also see that as far back in 1951, he was G2 in the Pentagon as deputy chief of the Eurasian branch. And what that means is that he oversaw all U.S. Army intelligence as far as north as Norway. That includes Finland, right? Far south is Morocco, to as far east is Afghanistan, to far west is Ireland. That's what Eurasian branch means. He was also the top U.S. interrogator for Russian defectors coming out of France and Switzerland after World War II. And in closing, two of the CIA's top Russian intelligence assets were none other than that fellow I mentioned before, Professor Nikolai Popp, who met with the General Vlasov of those fascist armies, and another fellow named Boris Smilovsky. Both Popp and Smilovsky, and this needs further research, but I've been given reason to believe that these guys were war criminals of the worst order and played a major role in the Holocaust in Russia itself. Popp is alleged to have been a Nazi intelligence operative employed by this organization that planned the extermination of Russian civilians. Remember, you know, 25 million Russians died, and 5.5 Russians were in Germany at the end of the war, many of them forced labor. Smilovsky was the commander of Sonderdivision R, a paramilitary death squad comprised of Russian army defectors who committed some of the worst heinous acts of savagery you can think of. Did Hoffman know who he's working with when he met with Nicholas Popp that night? Because Popp, you know, surrendered to Allied forces in France, and Smilovsky did, out in Liechtenstein, something like that. This is a heavy, heavy story. And the army defectors are right in the middle of it, and Oswald's history appears to be at the center of it, whether he's actually part of Hoffman's defector ring or not. So the research continues. If I can post a little bit more of this material at our next meeting a month from now, but I want to try to dig a little deeper into this Hoffman story because there's more to be learned. Thank you.
I'll just send you a link to your email on Marguerite, all my Marguerite files that I've...
Oh, that's great. Because Marguerite's the center of this. You know, I think the family was furious at Marguerite because she's playing some kind of footsie. Because this is the very period where Oswald loses his... he's punished during the summer of 1960. And he loses his honorable discharge. And now he's under their thumb for the rest of his life.
Hey, Bill, well, I've had a few people ask me, the emails that you send me that have these links and stuff in here, are those? Can I forward those to other researchers?
Let me put it this way. Some of this stuff I'm still working on, and I feel, when we get offline, I'll tell you, the first half I feel fine about. The last half, I want to document them a little further and make sure they're really sources that are completely solid. But all the stuff that's important is completely solid.
Okay.
I want to see some of the verification of some of this Nazi stuff. That's what I'm more worried about. I don't want to be spreading rumors about people being Nazis if it's not completely true.
Sure. Understandable.
Yeah.
And Bill, this is separate and apart from I just want people to understand, separate and apart from the displaced persons program that Harvey was running and also Shackley out of Berlin.
I don't know that's true. You see, I mean, Sloboda was a DP from 1952. That's about the time that Harvey became the chief of the Berlin station.
Right. Because I know when reading about him that this was a big part of, they were regularly, Shackley in particular, was regularly in charge of that program and sending, when the refugees would come into Berlin, he would be part of the team interviewing them and then find out which ones were suitable to go put back into their countries where they came from.
Well, I mean, it seems to, it's quite possible we're going to find out that Harvey and Shackley were the bosses of Hoffman. I just don't know exactly how the line of authority went.
Okay. That would really complicate things when you go to Cuba.
Cuba in some ways is a lot simpler than this because we have so many documents about Cuba.
Yeah.
When you want to research West Germany, you got to go into other lines of country than the Kennedy line.
But like when Harvey was in Italy during World War II, he's the one that set up the whole mafia, the mafia cooperating with us during World War II. Harvey's the one that set that up.
Yeah. Harvey is another triple threat man like Hoffman, like David Morales. These guys had more than one skill set.
Oh, yeah. You don't want one-trick ponies working for the Central Intelligence Agency.
No. You get to the top, you got to be good at a number of different things.
Yeah, I mean, Harvey's the one that was able to figure out Philby was the mole in M16, but Harvey's been characterized because of his drinking, but he was actually really good at what he did.
Well, that's why he was drinking so much. I mean, it was incredible tension that he was living
with.
Well, great stuff, Bill.
Thank you.
And reading here in the comments, everybody is saying great work and great presentation. That's a nice thing, and I like having Bill and Larry and Bart and everybody else who participates at our meetings because we get a chance to share things instead of waiting until conference time. We get a chance to share this about ongoing research that we're doing, everybody's doing during the year. So. It's exceptional to have the work that everybody puts in, and Bill, your work is definitely top of the food chain there when it comes to your research and also the fact of making sure that everything checks out correctly and it's well documented. So definitely great work on that, and I want to continue offering the olive branch to have you come out to our meetings each time and have you talk about it because it's invaluable to have it.
Well, it's good for me, too, because, doing a short presentation makes me really have to process it in my own head, see what's strong, see what's weak. And I want people to write me at bsimpich@gmail.com and tell me what they like, what they didn't like, what they'd like to see. I want feedback, in other words, because
I want more
around Marguerite and around the news media, like the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and Dallas in the early 60s, this military angle in West Germany and the Soviet Union. You can't do it by yourself. You've got to turn to other people for help.
Yeah. Yeah. Bill, just sorry to interject for the 10th time. If you want Russia, I can give that to you, but I'm telling you now, you're going to be completely flooded with documentation like there's never been a tomorrow anymore. It's just like, it's too much. I've got tons on Schneider, who of course was a CIA asset.
Oh yeah. No, I'll be honest. I don't need Schneider. I'm really not interested in anything but Hoffman, you know, the army attaché stuff.
I'll have a look.
Yeah, I've done my due diligence on Oswald and Russia.
I haven't read most of it, but the only thing that I've read from the whole Russia thing was a lot of people, and they brought it up in JFK, the movie as well, was that Oswald, with complete ease, got a new passport to travel back to the Soviet Union. And when the State Department officials are being asked about this, they've got a really simple answer that everybody basically has overlooked. And they really simply say, we didn't have any processes in place to not give him a passport after what he had done. The process was relatively, really simple, that basically if he applied to want a new passport, he could get it as such. There was nothing in place that would refuse him to give him a new passport to go back to the United States as such. Plus that loan, of course, to pay.
Right. Right. Thank you, Bart. And I don't need any of that stuff. I've spent many, many hours researching that, and I've resolved it more or less to my satisfaction. I am interested in, like, you know, the new material on the top of the Himalayas, which is people like Hoffman and, you know, all this defector network and this network that was running in West Berlin about penetration into the Soviet Union and these other countries.
And the interesting thing is when you look at the Warren Commission, I forgot if I mentioned this last time or not, when McCone and Helms were deposed by the Warren Commission, guess who was the person questioning them? Alan Dulles. And he was asking him questions about things that happened during Dulles's watch. And Dulles was able to give them, he actually led them through leading questions, basically trying to pin everything back on the State Department so that the CIA's stuff didn't come up on the record. It's amazing. I mean, how would you have the person who was in charge of the CIA when this stuff was happening was asking his successor about things that happened under his watch, the questioner. Amazing.
Yeah, and kind of, Alan Dulles is kind of like the spider's web here. I'm not big on Dulles being the mastermind, but Dulles is deep in this story. You know, I can amicably disagree with my friend David Talbot by saying he's the mastermind, but Oswald was fighting his way to Switzerland. Nobody knew Switzerland better than Alan Dulles. And when you try to follow, you know, people have written whole books trying to figure out about those schools that Oswald was trying to go to. And all they were really able to find out was that these people were certainly the big school was run by a Unitarian outfit. And nobody knew the Unitarians and the Quakers better than Alan Dulles, because he loved working with liberal anti-communists like Ruth and Michael Payne.
Right.
And that's the vein of this case, where you just keep seeing Dulles over and over and over again.
And I read that, I'm not sure this is right, Bill, but I read that Oswald's trip to Europe, ultimately ending up in Russia, would have cost more than he earned his entire time in the Marines.
Yeah, he used an expensive tourist outfit to tour him around. He had money. There's no way he didn't do that without somebody giving him money. He said he told his mama, you know, when he got out of the service, he was going to New Orleans to look for, you know, work. And instead, he hopped on a freighter and took a slow boat to the Soviet Union right during the period where Robert Webster was being hunted for. in
a high-end hotel, right? He stayed at a
luxury hotel. Yeah, and they go to a high-end hotel, and they're known socialist hotels, you know?
Yes.
And top of the line for socialists, you know? Pink and lots of money. And so they basically had Oswald on ice, the way I see it, until they located Webster, decided what they were going to do with him. And, you know, here's the other aspect of this.
Yeah.
I want everybody to tell me.
Hey, Bill, we're losing some of your audio there.
How's that? Better?
There you go.
Yeah.
It's
the newspaper tells a lot of the story. And so I really recommend people read the newspaper story first, because the newspaper story points out, for people who really understand the Oswald case, that not only was Hoffman in hot water and he couldn't really go back to the Soviet Union anymore, but they were kicking out Donald Winters, who was the economic attaché, who was buddies with Russell Langell, who got kicked out the week that Oswald came to town. Langell got kicked out. He was another State Department guy because he was had just been passed a note by Piotr Popov, who was American's big spy was arrested the very day that Oswald came to Moscow. And people felt that was not a coincidence. Langell was deported, and he did a brush spy with Popov that day, and he got deported. And that's what the article details. It was this whole spy ring, and Oswald's right in the center of it. Peter Dale Scott wrote a whole long, long analysis called The Search for Popov's Mole. And that article was one of the central things that got me into working on the Kennedy case, because I'd been studying, you know, CIA and how they'd, overthrown dozens of countries during my lifetime. And I'm like, you know, how can we get ourselves in this kind of, you know, situation? Where we're overthrowing these countries all the time, why, you know, are we doing this besides economic reasons? And so much of it has to do with, in my mind, just the nightmare of World War II and everybody's PTSD reaction. You know, it just became a Manichaean good, evil, black, white conflict. And the Kennedy case is right in the middle of all that. And people felt about Kennedy the way a lot of people feel about Trump today. You know, they'd like to kill him. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's the way it is.
In retrospect, you know, because he's a martyr, he seems really popular now. But at the time, you know, his popularity was in the 50s. It wasn't like 75%.
Children and lots of school children were cheering when he was killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bill, you've done some marvelous research on that. And, a lot of people look at linear research, and I think you've penetrated two or three levels of crust. Every time I tried to explain something to my wife, I said, the Kennedy assassination is layered. It's so layered with intelligence. And I said, we cut into military. And I said, I have to go back to World War II to try to explain, at least to my students, that in order to be able to understand or facilitate an understanding about the murder of JFK, you have to have an understanding about what came out of World War II in Europe and Asia and Berlin at that particular time. And I said, if you can't grasp that, then you may not be able to understand where we're going to go with trying to pinpoint somebody for the murder of JFK, or at least the aspects of how it came about. And I think I don't want to say you're right online, but I would say you've penetrated some areas that I think that are very, very important, especially when you open up Europe. Germany at the end, and well, obviously Russia too, at the end of World War II, and who was controlling whom at that particular time. So that very, very good research that really creates an opportunity for. Yeah.
No, that means a lot to me what you just said, because you really are nailing it. The biggest thing for me in this whole research was the 5.5 million. Soviets that were in Germany at the end of World War II. I had no idea it was that many. I mean, and most of those people are forced labor. They're slaves. You know, they're slaves. This is white people, as blunt as I get, this is white people making other white people slaves. It's in the heart of war. And
it really is.
The worst kind of war. And this traumatizes everybody. This traumatized the Germans. This traumatized the Soviets. And this traumatized the United States and the Brits and anybody who was close to it, you know? These are
really
terrible things that happen.
When you to learn about the conditions in Central Europe after the Nazis surrendered, it really it's an amazing story. I mean, it's our southern border on steroids.
Oh God!
And Berlin was the only haven these people had, West Berlin, and they were fleeing into West. I mean, it is just the amount of the idea they had the refugee camps in Europe from all the displaced people. That Eastern Europe, that the Russian Soviets had taken over. I mean, it's just mind-boggling when you read about it. I mean, just think about what's happening, you know, at our border, and just multiply that, right? And then think about as if Mexico was a communist country, we would be trying to send those people back to try to, you know, it's just an amazing story that has been lost to history, most of the details.
Well, I really see this is where you can see this is where I'm going with my research. I'm setting up a website called Cold War History, U.S. Cold War History.
Yeah.
And it'll take a little while to come up. And it's going to be focusing on trying to unearth this story. Because I think, you know, the world is not really dealt with that trauma.
No. And if, you know, there was a movie in 2007 called The Company. Roger Littell wrote that book, a 700-page book. It's now on, it's available now on Amazon Prime for $7. But that's his fictional history. And he, you know, Harvey's in there. All those players are in there. Harvey is thinly disguised, but most of the other players, the names he used. But that really is an inside look at the CIA and what happened in Europe in the 50s. And it's a great movie. It's about a 3-hour movie. It is, but the book is 700 pages. But it's a really interesting.
I'm going to watch the movie first.
Yes. You have to watch the movie first because at least, you know, they take only parts of the book, but at least you can visualize when you start, because the book is like real, it's really good. I mean, it's, but that really gives you a feel for what was going on then.
Thank you.
The Company.
You know, here's the thing, like in teaching American history, at least to juniors and seniors in high school and then going on to college, there obvious are a lot of gaps in American history that we just brush over. Like, for instance, the between 1865 and 1877, I think after the Civil War, I think everybody thought that, well, we're just going to go back to our home and relive our normal life. Well, when you get to the end of World War II, you know, the Americans are celebrating and the Brits are celebrating to a certain extent. But, you know, the problem with that is that I think everybody in America thinks, well, all those people are just going to go back to their homes. Oh, God, there is no homes for them.
Right.
It is totally destroyed. Somebody's got to come in and set boundaries and set up banking systems and governments and get these displaced people back to where you know wherever they came from. And it's a lost gap in American history. And I think we're loaded with those things. And I know the Black Lives Matter situation when you're talking about Tulsa. Oh, that thing was totally wiped out.
Oh my God.
No, right. But let me, Casey. Let me. I want to put a point to that. The key part of that era was what happened in Hungary in 56.
Yes.
And when I hear people now trying to squelch people's First Amendment rights, the part of the book, the movie, where you have these people rebelling against the Soviet-sponsored government, they want the right to speak. And when people, the First Amendment in this country is underappreciated, its value. And what I'm really trying to emphasize now to younger people is to appreciate this right, because it's the same right that allowed our generation to protest the Vietnam War by burning our American flags and burning our draft cards, right? My colleagues who did that.
Yeah.
That right also protects, like, the ACLU protecting the Nazis in Skokie in the 70s, right?
Yeah. It does.
And when you look at what people died for in Europe, the ability to speak their mind, that is what is being lost now with this whole cancel culture and with this whole woke culture about trying to, like, tell, stop or squash speech. And it's important to see what is at risk. And because people don't understand what happened, and Casey, forgive me for saying this because you teach, but I teach older adults, you know, in your 20s. But it feels like this generation, it's like, it's the phrase is before me, BM. Nothing counts before they were born.
Absolutely.
And so they're not learning the lessons of history.
Let me dive in now. I think what they've learned is it's not enough to be invoking the First Amendment. It's time to invoke the powers of antitrust. Because you can't face off Facebook, you know, and Twitter when they give, you know, people like Trump, you know, a platform that's unassailable and then take it away without any due process, which is also terrible, right?
Right. Right. Exactly.
Neither thing is good. And the point here is the First Amendment is not really the avenue to be fighting a lot of these battles at this point. The place to be fighting is antitrust, because people should not have this much power to speak, period. You
this
know,
is why someone
needs to be broken down, and that's what and our antitrust laws are so weak right now that a few big companies control most of our activities. I set up my TV last night. You know, a nice big new TV. I had to hook into Google and Apple and all these things I didn't want to do in order to make the sound work.
Smart TV is terrible.
It's as if a single landlord owned every open space in New York City, and they could then determine what is said in those open spaces. The town squares, as if every town square was owned by one or two companies, and therefore this is the place where people come to talk, and they were owned by one or two companies. That is what we effectively have now in this country.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Thank you.
Yes. Anyway, I just want to link with Bill and what we've all talked about to make it current to now that people have forgotten what was that real. There was a real concern that Europe was going to go communist and all these people were going to lose their voices amongst other things.
That's right.
Is what people so, and Bill, you're right. They're trying to use the First Amendment to squash. The other thing is that they're also trying to squash thought that they don't agree with. And it feels like we're raising, I'm sorry, I have to say this. I feel like we're raising a whole fragile generation where they can't take thought that they don't agree with. But that's what a democracy is. You work
out.
I
know why that is, why they can't talk, why they can't have it, why other people put a different argument for it.
But I'm a little on the right side of some of these issues. So I apologize if I offend anybody.
No,
but
that's not a problem at all.
But this is, again, how to make what we're doing that's almost 70 years old. Why is it relevant to today's generation? And this is what is their risk if they don't, if these people, by next year, do you know that 75% of the office space occupied in this country is going to be occupied by millennials? 75% of the office space.
Thank God.
they're the ones that are still stupid enough to travel into work like that. I mean,
but the point is that they're the ones now are going to be driving the policy and economic decisions of this country, and they don't have sufficient experience or understanding of what happened before their time. And this is a risk as we
Larry, I agree with you 100%, And just the other day, I was online looking at the teaching jobs that are open. And my brother got a hold of me and he says, I don't see any history or any social studies jobs, geography, economics. And I said, hell, I said, you won't see those. All you're going to see is math and science and technology. And I said, those jobs are going to be filled because that's the future. And I said, nobody wants to hear what happened in the past. And you're right. We've drawn a line, and that line is from now on, not the past. But we've got to look to the past to try to figure out what the hell's going on so that we can live out, hopefully, a little bit better life than what we have. But God, if our kids don't understand what the hell the past is, we're in trouble. And that's what my brother told me. He says, you need to go out and keep teaching. And I said, God, I said, I can't get a job.
Right. The reason you learn about the ancient Greeks is because human nature doesn't change.
Yes.
And one, right? And it's like as if the world started in 2000, the 21st century. Nothing happened before then. Anyway, I just digress. And I just, when I heard Bill and heard you talk, I just wanted to, and this, if anything else, in that portion of the movie where you have the Hungarians are warned by the CIA, don't do this. We're not going to support you. And they just go ahead and do it anyway, and they get slaughtered.
1956, right? Yeah.
What? Yeah, 56, yeah.
56, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I got to throw this in because it just popped in my head, and if I don't talk about it, I'm going to forget about it later. But it's almost like the Twilight episode of the obsolete man. We're becoming obsolete men and women in the research community because this happened before 2000, like Larry just said. You know, there's no need for librarians or teachers or, you know, different people of that, you know, caliber teaching of the past. Well, we still have to teach about the past because if we don't, we're destined to repeat it in the future.
Was that the guy? Was that the actor from Rocky? That was that obsolete man. Who was the actor that played that?
I want to say it was. He also Burgess Meredith.
Yes.
Yeah, Burgess Meredith. He did a lot of Twilight episodes. But I remember that one. Like I say, it just popped in my head. His name was, I think, Wadsworth. Don't quote me on that, but I think that's what it was. But yeah, it just seems like what we've got today as far as in teaching institutions and just in the general public with having social media that's the 24-hour news cycle of things. That's what's talked about. The younger generation, the millennials, the, I don't know if we want to call them snowflakes or not, but, they just seem to not give a damn about anything other than what took place on, something of a reality TV. Well, hell, this is reality. This happened, you know, to our world leader. This is what happened in our history. So that's why we still need to talk about it because if we don't teach it, or if we don't talk about it, they're not going to learn this stuff in school. So it makes it important for us to keep talking to the younger generation, let them know that, just because it didn't happen since you were born doesn't mean it didn't count or it didn't matter.
It is our fault, Casey, because I remember, I think you and I are approximately the same age, but I remember in 11th grade is when we rejected the curriculum of our elders, and we started asking for relevancy, and so it began with our generation, but we had at least up until our 11th or 10th grade, we had a good foundation in history, but then we're the ones that said it's only relevant, and the baby boomers really, to answer a question by Brooks, that I think we're the ones to blame, because we're the ones that changed our country. And it's really the kids. We can't blame the kids because they're not being taught to be interested. It's our generation that basically changed the rules, and the kids are just following what we taught them or didn't teach them, in my opinion.
Well, I'll tell you what. When I was teaching full time, a lot of my students thought I was straight out of Hayden Ashbury. I would sit back saying, for God's sake, guys. I don't even know what pot is. Well, I did when I got to Vietnam. But anyway, let me clear that up. But
Casey, it's being recorded.
Yeah, I know, guys. Darn it. I can I run for a New York position there? Probably not. Anyway, the mayor's open over there from what I understand. But it was one of those things where a lot of the kids basically thought that at that particular time that I was a hippie, and I said, well, no, I'm probably more of a yippie than that. They go, what the hell's a yippie? And I said, well, I don't even want to get into that. But, crazy stuff. But at the same time, I was taking a course at a University of Kansas with a professor that was saying that we have to have teachers that can tell stories. And I sat back and I said, well, I think I'm a storyteller. But he says, in order to be able to tell a story, you have to have lived it. So you have to be, you know, old enough to be able to sit back and say, okay, this is what I do. For instance, the other night, my wife was asking me, how come you can sit down and watch a baseball game and really get something out of it? And I said, well, I coached baseball for 40 years. I played it. But she says, it's just such a slow and meticulous game. And I said, well, then you like hockey, you like basketball, you like football. And football's ordered like everything else is. But at the same time, she says, baseball is so slow. And I said, well, but it's calculating. I mean, you have nine ball players out there trying to figure out what's going on, and you see all different positions. And I said, and if you want to get into something deeper, well, then open up a book on JFK.
It's amazing you're still married.
Well, I'm on my second marriage.
My prior wife, I was with her for 20 years, and she still didn't know what right field was.
Well, I got to second base several times, so. Now we're figuring out how old you are. I'm trying to figure out if Larry Rivera's laughing at that, for God's sake.
We are way off topic, but,
yes,
you know.
Yes, we are.
What happens when David doesn't have enough speakers?
Well, let's roll this back in a little bit more into our meeting of the journey. Would anybody like
journey.
To...
journey we're going on, by the way. I'm shutting up now.
Can I make a comment about the post-World War II and the Cold War, apropos of what Bill was saying, and where JFK fits into it? Which is that JFK's post-World War II view was very, very different than the Alan Dulles's of the world. And this is covered very well in the book Ghost by Jeff Morley.
Yes.
And also Talbot does a terrific job on Dulles and speaking of Switzerland. And the whole world view of the old guard was very different than Kennedy's worldview. And when he was in the Senate, he was known as the leader of the neo-colonialists. Now, that's a mouthful, but his whole war view, which was reflected in his foreign policy, was very different than the old guard and certainly than the Pentagon. You know how the expression is, the Army's always fighting the last war? Well, the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies were very much in contempt, virtual contempt of Kennedy and his whole war view, which was reflected in his foreign policy. And I would point you to Jim DiEugenio has written some good stuff about Kennedy's foreign policy and why he was loathed by the people who may have had a hand in getting him out of power. And so the American University speech is reflective of a new worldview. And, you know, that alone was enough to make some very, very powerful enemies.
Well, he was the first one born in the 20th century to be president, right?
That's right.
He was, in essence, like an early boomer. I mean, you know, the way we change things, he was representing a whole different view.
Right. And when Kennedy, when he was in the Senate, made his speeches about Algeria and the French, they were against persons who were literally trying to assassinate de Gaulle during even the first year Kennedy was in office. And there was the OAS in France was pro-keeping Algeria as a colony. They were planning a coup in France against de Gaulle for the week following the Bay of Pigs, which I think they may have known about, some of these ultra-right people. So I just want to make that worldview comment, post-World War II and how Kennedy's view was so different. I think Lisa Pease in our last conference made a comment in the chat room that his assassination, Kennedy's assassination, was not about passion or revenge, but it was about greed and power. And I think that that is true. The worldview of those people, it was worth trillions and trillions of dollars to them in the long run.
Mona Lisa.
Well, actually, that was Lisa Hardy that made that comment our last meeting. Lisa Pease wasn't with us, but Lisa Hardy, she's in our audience.
Oh.
I know she has a little issue with her microphone, but she's able to talk in the chat log. And, yeah, she made some really great points
at our last meeting.
Great comment. That was a good comment. I'm looking into Larry Hancock's book and looking into the background, a little bit more of the background of the Washingtonian or the D.C. set of people who I guess were classified the elites or part of the company. And
was that in Tipping Point?
And that's in the book Tipping Point. But I'm trying to go outside that to try to bring in the image of Richard Bissell. And there must have been some tremendous hate between the Bissells and the Kennedys, because when Bissell did not pass on the information to the his subordinates that JFK supposedly wasn't going to send in air support in Cuba, well, JFK was going to send in air support. He called these people back. Well, it goes back to my college professors saying that, you know, you're going to have to wait 50 to 100 years before the documents will be unclassified so you can find out what the true thing is. Well, Larry Hancock has got those documents right now, and I'm sitting there going, Bissell is a damn liar. Not only is he a damn liar, why does he hate the Kennedys so much and pass it on that? And I think that created a whole generation of hate toward JFK, who are now, and I hope I don't step on anybody's feet on this, but who are now Latino Republicans in Florida.
And Casey, have you read Evan Thomas's book when he profiles Bissell?
Poor man.
What?
Desmond Fitzgerald, doesn't he do him?
Yep. Who's the guy that basically ran the Bay of Pigs for Bissell? His right hand.
Cabell.
No.
Cabell was with Bissell, but it was passed on to. Let me think.
But there were four blue bloods. I'll get the book. But that, if you haven't read that book,
no, I need to read that.
Yeah, let me. I'll get the
four who dared.
Is that what it is? The four who dared?
Yeah, the very best men. Four who dared. Bissell, Barnes, Fitzgerald, Wisner.
That's it. Yeah. It's the very best men.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
This is a good book. This is a fascinating book because it's the four. It profiles the four of them. There's tons of information in here. You would really enjoy this. You know how Larry and I loved Blonde Ghost? This is a book for you.
This is a book right there. I'll do that.
Now Larry, while you've got that book in your hand, who's the author of that book?
Evan Thomas.
Evan Thomas. Okay.
Yeah. This is a really good, because it profiles the four of them.
It's well written. I recommend it too.
Yeah.
That book will go back into World War II quite a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's crisscross. Yeah. But I mean, I have I have three different marking systems. I have yellow, orange, and blue. So my pages are all multicolored.
What? Not green? Come on.
Well, green is not good because you can take blue and yellow and that becomes green. Right? So if I do a blue over a yellow, the first cut is always yellow.
Yeah, that complements your colors.
I can't use green because then it confuses me.
Yeah, I stopped doing that and I started using the real skinny sticky notes.
Yeah.
And I now have twice as many sticky notes than the actual pages in the book.
I have fallen into that trap as well because I used to use Post-its. But the Post-its always bend and they just start to tear. And then I got these plastic tabs, basically, that are like the replacement of sticky notes. And before I know it, I've almost got like a piano keyboard on the side of the book.
Oh, good Lord, yeah.
Bart, sticking out.
Bart, you're the kind of guy I could see that would actually argue with the author in the margins of the book.
I like it. It's good.
I'll tell you what, though. Now you're mentioning that. I was at Malcolm's, and he's got a copy of Best Evidence, which, of course, is Lifton. But it's got annotations from Harry Livingston on the side of it.
I did that with Bela Lugosi's
book. I'm wetting myself laughing, basically, because of this, like, liar, you fucker, this, that, and the other. Just, like, going mental about, like, the statements from Lifton as such. And he's just tearing him a new one. Just, that's just, you know, whether I agree or not, but it's just funny just to see all that, just out in the open as such. So, but, no, that's one of the books where I basically saw some annotations on the side. But Malcolm does it on his documents as well and basically points out and goes, have a look at this date, and this is really quick, and this, that, and the other. So he does the same thing, you know.
Yeah, those little anecdotes.
I have one request before I sign off. I wanted to ask if anybody has good stuff on I've been to Bart's site, so I've been reading all of his Joe Molina and William Lowry stuff. Next month, I want to do the Dallas Communists and fellow travelers and cops before the assassination, because I'm working on a thought that Oswald might have, in fact, taken the place of Bill Lowry, who was the Communist Party head, who was actually an FBI informant. He came out as a FBI informant right at the time that Oswald supposedly went to Mexico City. So I keep wondering if the reason Oswald was hanging out on the back steps, first floor, second floor, was to track Joe Molina. Because Lowry had tracked Molina for 10 years and he couldn't do it anymore. Molina had worked at that place since 1947, and he was a rather conservative man, but he was the head of the American GI Forum. A lot of people thought he was a communist.
A lot of new files came out on Molina. In fact, I actually dedicated an entire chapter to him. And this Lowry guy was, in fact, you know, a communist infiltrator. And there's a lot of information on him. In fact, when Joe Molina had his deposition for the Warren Commission, he tried to talk about Lowry.
Right, they wouldn't let him. Yeah,
they wouldn't let him. They wouldn't let him.
Yeah, and you know who was representing him was an FBI agent who represented him for free and wouldn't let the Warren Commission question Lowry about his interactions with Jim Hostey and the other FBI guys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of material there, and I've done a lot of research and a lot of writing on it. So I'd like to collaborate.
The amount of material that's still around and that needs to be looked into is huge. Huge. A lot of people think like, it's all been looked at. Nah.
No.
There's loads of stuff spread all over town.
And I'd like to share something here real quick, if I may. And I sent this to Larry last time, and it has to do with De Bruy's report written on 10/25/63, and it happens to cover the exact days that, you know, that are so controversial about Lee Oswald. If you see here at the top from 8/9/63 to 10/15/63. And what's interesting about this, and I've posted the NARA numbers, the RIF numbers up here in case anybody wants to jot them down. But this is a 40-page report. And there's only three of the pages that survived in the document. If you go to the cover page here, it says 40 pages, all right? But and it mentions that, you know, they're tracking Lee Oswald out of New Orleans, and apparently they're very interested in his activities. But, you know, my point here is if they were tracking his activities, you know, in such a crucial time, wouldn't this report have noted that he was planning on going to Mexico City and that he had taken he had bothered to get his visas to go to Mexico City and this and that, but nothing of the sort. In fact, the report, like I said, it's only two or three pages survive. And what's interesting here are the sources, the informants that are in this report. Orlando Piedra, who was notorious in Cuba.
Right.
Yeah, right. And then Jesse Corr, who was Clay Shaw's public relations director at the International Trademark.
Yeah, and he was reporting the whole time. I got a lot of stuff on Core. This is a great document. I totally agree. I've seen it before.
Yeah, so this whole thing on the Bruins, you know, were then compounded by the fact that Orestes Peña, in his HSCA testimony, you know, he was adamant about the relationship between the Bruins and Oswald, and that the Bruins followed Oswald to Dallas when he left New Orleans. Now,
I'll tell you one thing right now about this document. The CIA thought this document was so important, Larry, that they made three cards for Oswald. One was called Lee Henry Oswald. Another card was called Lee Harvey Oswald. The third one was called Lee H. Oswald. Mm-hmm. And it was based on this very Du Bois report.
Yeah. And why now if and this is Larry asked me for this document to see if maybe there would be the possibility of getting the entire report, which, wishful thinking there. But this Orlando Piedra, interestingly enough, if you go down here, I've got a picture of the guy. And because he was, he had very close ties to the FBI during his days as chief of the Cuban Bureau of Investigation under Batista, okay? And his the address of his business happens to be in Lee Oswald's address book. And I have it right here. Okay. I got this information from this Cuban blogger, and it's in Spanish. Okay. But the translation here says, counting on other acts by Piedra, the assassination of John Kennedy and plans to attack Fidel Castro, Piedra was questioned at that time by the FBI in relation to the Magnicide in Dallas, where documents mentioning the ex-Cuban colonel and his address were found on Lee Oswald. And I went and checked it out, and sure enough, 117 Camp Street is in Lee Oswald's address book. So there you go.
What's Magnicide? What's Magnicide?
Magnicide is a homicide or a murder that is the biggest, magnanimous.
A big deal.
It's in Spanish. It's a Spanish translation.
Yeah, right. I was trying
Magnicidio,
to.
Magnicidio. So.
But, hey, someone asked me what happened to Ramon Herrera. He's disappeared on all the pages, and someone's looking for him. Does anyone know what happened to him? Is he still around?
Sylvia Odio's husband?
Ramon Herrera, who's a researcher.
JFK numbers?
Oh, yeah.
He did all that research?
Yeah. He's apparently gone dark, and someone's trying to find him. Does anyone know, anyone have heard from him or know anything about him?
Do you know anything about this document? Why there's only three pages?
There may be more. There may be other versions of this book.
I know. That's why it's got four different narrow numbers.
Mm. Right. That seems right. No, it's a very important document, and I think that's probably why we don't see all of it.
Can I ask you a question, please? When Oswald was arrested for disturbing the peace when he was handing out the leaflets, while he was in custody with the New Orleans Police Department, mm-hmm. he asked to see an FBI agent.
Right.
Now, was that DeBries?
No, that was Quigley.
Oh, Quigley, right, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
And it's in the CAC report. There's a report. The only source for that information is there's a document, FBI document called the CAC report. CAKAACK, and that's where you find the mention of Quigley.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, but I consider that a very, very important document because if it would have aided in the lone nut scenario, they would have been, Mexico City would have been all over there,
Cards. There seems to be, I just wanted to share this with you, this Lee H. Oswald legend seems to have been a new legend that was created literally that day from that document. And we don't see Lee H. Oswald on that document. But I could send you the three index cards. There's some kind of game being played.
Absolutely.
With these three figures.
Absolutely.
And they're the same person, but
they're using them for different purposes. And I don't know what the Lee H. Oswald legend is about. It's always been a mystery to me. I think I figured out the Lee Henry Oswald. I think it was done for mole hunting. But I think the Lee H. Oswald is something I do not have an answer for.
Yeah, and the Odeo visit is also included in that time frame. You know, so, you know, that's a very important document.
Well, you know, there's a whole discussion that I could have another day, not right now, but about the Dallas Cubans. I've always felt the last 4 months of Oswald's life, I've done Harlandale. I've done a lot of research into the Harlandale thing, and every time I think there's nothing there, I keep saying, well, you know, the Pino family was pretty important, and so was another, Manuel Acabera. Both those figures seem to be pretty important in terms of the Cuban war. These guys were heavy hitters.
Yeah.
So I don't want to write off the Dallas Cuban story. I think it's really important.
I agree with you, Bill. There's loads behind it. I've got two photographs that Malcolm gave me of an Alpha 66 meeting in Dallas. And with a bit of imagination, you could probably see or think you can see Oswald standing in the background of one of those shots as such. I posted them at the education forum about 2 or 3 years ago. I'll have to dig them up again. But, these were good prints as such. And, overall, the Harlandale thing and all the other little tidbits left, right, and center as to it wasn't so much out in the open as it was in New Orleans, for instance. But there is loads to look for in Dallas. And this is what actually needs to be investigated by someone that basically says, yeah, I'm going to find out about the Cuban presence in Dallas as such and just go deep into it as such and try to talk
to people. There's a document that says that Silvio Odeo had seen him mesmerize audiences with his, you know, talk, you know, and talking to the Cuban exiles and everything, and he had shown how smart, intelligent, how well versed he was, and informed, and everything, you know. And that's something to look into.
Real problem. She called him a double agent. She thought he was working both sides of the fence. I think she's absolutely right.
Well, it's when he shows up on her doorstep, you know, on September the 27th, you know.
I'm not sure whether Odeo saw Lee Oswald.
That's a great mystery. But I think the double agent thing was interesting because she got that from other people. She didn't get that from the doorstep.
Oh, no,
she was an active jure activist on the liberal side of the helm. And so, you know, and there was conflict between jure and the more conservative.
I've got a stack of documents on Odeo, and it sows more doubt than actually saying, like, oh, yeah, this is definitely synced and sorted out and as presented.
But tell me about it. Her brother, Caesar, actually told the FBI that this thing about her fainting at work isn't what really happened. She and her sister happened to have been at the trademark hoping to see Kennedy to see about getting him interceding to get the release of her father Amador from the Cuban from Cuban prison there with where was he in La Cabana or something like that, and that's where they were at the time of the assassination, not at work, you know, where, you know, the legend that she fainted when she found out, when she saw that it was Lee Oswald or whatever. In reality, her and her sister I believe Annie were down at the trademark hoping to, talk to JFK in person. So, you know, there you go.
Well, the Odeo story has never been very well investigated. And part of the problem is, except for those two interviews by the Warren Commission and the HSCA, you know, Sylvia doesn't really want to talk. And
well, Liebler just wanted to get into her pants.
In her pants. No, it was awful. It was awful. But, you know, I can swing either way on Sylvia Odeo, for example. I can say she's a good actor. I can say she's a bad actor. I can say she's a confused actor. I feel like what we don't have is literally enough data, even after all this time, even after all those interviews. It's a real problem.
Speaking about data, David and Casey, can you give us an update on the scanning activities of you guys, what you've been doing lately and stuff?
Well, actually, yeah, I was just getting ready to, I have something I want to unveil to you, Bart, and I'll unveil it to everybody, because here's a new piece of technology I'll talk about in just a couple of minutes. But we are continuing on the Dick Russell collection, and we're probably about, I would say, working on between the third and the halfway point of getting the rest of the collection done. And we still have, I mean, we're basically in that first third to first half, and then we're trying to kick it in the ass and get more of it done. I'm hoping if we could work it out, we could possibly have all the stuff we got from Baylor done. And I'm not throwing this timeline out, you know, 100%, but I'm thinking by, like, say, September, I'd like to have it finished by September, at the very latest October. One thing that I wanted to show to you in particular, Bart, because I told you about the scanners that we use, let me do a share screen here real quick, and anybody that is interested may find this helpful. This is the Iris Scan Book 5 and 5 Wi-Fi. Now, let me just tell everybody, yes, Bart, you can order it overseas. You're looking basically, I don't know, in pounds, I'm guessing $99 in
U.S. Yeah.
And euros. Okay. Well, what this thing does is it digitizes books, magazines. You can use it anywhere, even without a computer. You can convert it to documents and editable files in Word, Excel, PDF, etc. You can create index PDF files. It's got a built-in color LCD screen for previewing your document. Direct scanning to PDF or JPEG format. And you don't have to rip apart a book, a magazine, to take something out of it that you want to use. And you can also use this on standard documents. Now, I don't know how this would work I know when we went to the Dallas Public Library, we couldn't put any pressure, like running things through a mechanical feeder. We were able to do some things on a flatbed scanner. This is even lighter. Hardly any pressure. You're not doing anything but either basically laying at the top, going top to bottom, or the inside to the outside. You can scan one page per second. It has a built-in battery. You can scan about 100 pages. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole hell of a lot, you know, but you can plug in the micro USB cable and continue scanning all damn day long. It also has a place to put a micro SD memory card in, so you could scan. You know, here's just a standard page invoice that you could basically scan in, and then it goes wirelessly either to a cell phone, a tablet. You could put it onto onto your computer also. The Book Scan 3, which is the old version, was $99. The Book 5 and the Book 5 Wi-Fi, they're normally $149 and $169. They're now $129 each. If there's a Micro Center, an Office Depot, Office Max, Staples, they actually carry these in the store. So you don't have to order one online. You can go out to those stores, and most of those have price match guarantee. So if you go and show them the irislink.com website and show them the price, they will match that price.
Do you run it down the page, or do you just hold it over the page?
No, you just basically you actually physically put it on the page and just hit the scan button. Pull it all the way to the bottom, hit the scan button again, and you've got your digitized image, and it scans in 300, 600, and 1200 DPI. You can scan black and white, grayscale, or color. And if anybody wants to know more about this, I know I'm going to actually contact them and let them know what kind of work that we do with digitizing, archiving documents. And I'm going to see if they will send us one out for a test, and then, of course, I'll do a review on it and talk about it on the show.
Good
and,
idea.
You know, maybe they will send one out to us where we don't have to purchase it, but even if we do, I think it's worth the $129 plus tax to be able to go out and scan things. And the other thing is, say you have a big piece of newspaper, okay, a standard newspaper size. You can scan basically in probably two, maybe three swipes, and then you can use a thing called Microsoft Stitch, and it will stitch those images together flawlessly, and that way you can create the entire pages. I mean, I use Cam Scanner on my Android device, but like I say, I saw this, and I said, you know what? This might give us a better image quality, might be faster. You're not having to worry. And another thing is no matter – say you have a piece of news. I know I've seen this in Dick Russell's collection. There's newspaper pieces, but they, you know, if they're small enough, they go through the document scanner. They go on the flatbed scanner. But if it's an entire sheet of paper, you can't fit that on any scanner unless you've got a big scanner you can send it through and digitize it that way. This way here, you actually pull it down. So instead of having that crease in the paper, and sometimes you can't read the words in that crease, this actually physically puts it on the paper and will flatten it as you're scanning. So I think it has multiple possibilities, and at $129, it's readily attainable for anybody that wants to scan things. You can scan photographs with this too. So I just wanted to show it to you, Bart, because I know that you can get it in hell damn near any country you want, United States, Canada, Brazil, Europe, Asia, out in the Pacific. You can order this anywhere, or you can go to a store and pick it up. So I just wanted to show that and let people know that that technology that we didn't have before is now out there. Plus, it's come down quite a bit in price. So I think it's something that we definitely could use in the instance of scanning documents, archiving. And I'm pretty excited. I showed it to Brian and Casey, and they're like, yeah, shut up and take my money. I'm like, yeah, exactly. So I'm going to try to see if we can get one donated to us from Iris. Now, Iris is a company owned by Canon, from what I'm reading in the research. Canon backs it. I know I use Epson products for our scanning scanners and printers and things like that. But I have no problem using another company's software and also their hardware to complete our job that we're doing. So I think it's a great idea.
I think it's a great idea to do newspapers with that because of its size.
Oh.
And I'm going to tell Alan Dale about this because apparently Jim Lazar has bought so many old newspapers that they wanted to get them scanned in, and I thought, well, maybe you have to do real photographic reproductions. But if you have something like that that comes with the software, which gets rid of the creases as well, which is, of course, is very nice, so you get a really nice front cover copy. But look, I'm not bragging here, but I've done more than 120,000 pages. And if I've got that thing in my hand for 120,000 pages, it'll end up getting thrown at the wall. Simple as that. Yeah? End of the debate. That thing goes against the wall. It'll just get chucked because you know what? I have tried two scan software and I both used them on my iPhone.
Here we go. Here comes the rant.
Yeah, ranting hour. And I've had, I lost 100 scans. Like I did 100 scans and it just went foobar. It just disappeared. It just crashed. And you lose 100 scans, and you go, I've been standing here for 15 minutes, clicking away, and it's all gone. And with the first scanning software that I had, I think it was called iScan, oh, mate, you should have heard me in the street. They could hear me, I'll tell you. And this last one, which is Adobe Scan, that's pretty good, although it also has a couple of iffy things on it. You just sometimes have to restart the software because after a while, the cache or whatever the hell, the memory, it's just been overloaded, so I can't take it anymore. And sometimes I do up to 1,000 scans a day. So there's, you know, and for me, for simplicity, but I want a document feeder so I can just do other things and just put 50 pages into a thing and go, right, there you go. But then I've got other problems because since Malcolm's archive is definitely the most disorganized archive that's around. I swear to God. Just imagine tossing everything out the first floor and then putting it back together again, okay? So it's all in his head, but the paperwork is all over the place. Even if I just researched for my own stuff, I would have had to go through every folder to see if there's not something in there that is up to my interest as such.
So how hard is it, Bart?
What's supposed to be hard? Which
egg him on? Come on now, egg him on.
Right. Johnny Carson, you know how hard is it? You know.
Well, let me tell you this. In the last 2 months, I've had one day off, and I'm talking 7 day weeks. And on average, I do about anything between 700 and 1,000 PDFs a month, and about pages that depends, but this year so far.
Give it 100. That's only like
25,000.
30 days in the month, 700. That's only like 20 a day, right?
That's enough because some of them are hundreds. They have 100, 200, 300 pages.
Oh, God,
okay.
Yeah. So, and the thing is also, when you do 100, the thing is also the quality of the copies, you know. When I say, Malcolm, some of this stuff is so on the piss, right? It's just like this. And he goes, yeah, I might have mucked up a bit with the Xeroxing. I'm like, right, okay. But I'm not going to spend time on straightening things up and God knows what, because that all takes time. You see, when you start doing so much material, like I have here, you just want to get a system on the go and just bash it out. Yeah, and I tell you what, if somebody wants to straighten a document out, knock yourself out, open Paint or open Photoshop and just get on it and just straighten it out. Boom. Because I've done my share. I've scanned it all in. I made it public for everybody to play with.
Right.
That's why I draw the line, because the thing is, I do anything between 8 and 14 hours a day on this stuff. It's that much that I'm going, you know what? someone else can do something else, the rest of it, and I'll just scan it in and I'll share it, and there you go. So, that's my thing. I hope to be finished in September, but he also all of a sudden came up to me and he goes, well, you can have all my Novchenko documents. And I looked at it, and it was like a box, like, massive! Could almost put a body in it, and I was like, right. And he says, well, you can have that. And I said, no, I'm going to finish the warehouse first, because once I'm done with the warehouse, then I can continue with what I did, what was at home. And that's another thing. He's got like tons of Vesiana stuff and tons of Novchenko. And then, of course, all kinds of spook-related matters that he's been looking into. And I've been getting hold of some of the stuff that he lent to me, because he's like, oh, can you bring that back? Normally, he doesn't give it to us, but this was like, no, can you bring that back, because that's still being investigated as such by him and looked into. But the amount is just is crazy. And this project was only supposed to last 6 months, and it's been now in October, it's going to be 3 years that I've been at it, basically. So, yeah, and also I'm getting really fed up with it. I've gone to a point where I'm like, fuck off, I don't want anything to deal with this anymore. I've had enough of it, so, but... It's better than reading the book. That's what I can say.
But you said that it was pissed off or something, or what was the word you used about the condition of the document?
On the piss is meaning not straight, like so. So it's not straight,
okay.
But it's not aligned, so it's on the piss. So
on the piss, okay.
On
that's
the piss.
We're just trying to add to the Bart
Yeah. At the end of this year, you have a nice little booklet together with terms and
I
phrases.
I think we should sell it. It could be, you know, a nice collection. Maybe it's a gift for people that, you know, make a major contribution to the site. And it could be the Bart Gallery of terms and, you know.
I like that. That's good.
Well, I will say I got a comment here that came in from Bob Sultan. I asked me if I have a device that can do high-quality scans of color negatives. And one of my pieces of equipment is the Epson V600 photo scanner. It's basically it's a scanner that has it's a flatbed scanner that has a light and a sensor on the actual flatbed and the one in the lid. And the scans that I've done from J. Gary Shaw's collection that are on our website, those were scanned in at 48-bit color, 3200 DPI, which are the best scans that have ever been made of those slides. Not to pat myself on the back so hard I break my damn arm, but you know, they're better than what you're going to find anywhere online on Google Images or even they look better than what I've seen on any other website.
I don't want to steal your crown. I don't want to steal your crown, David, but my scanner is better. So hand them over. Hand them over now. So
hey, David, before you go down this rat hole about slides, I was asking specifically about negatives.
So you have
the software with the Epson scanner.
Well, actually my scanner actually has the insert platforms that you actually put on the flatbed. So that's what I'm saying. You've got the light that comes through the bottom and the light that comes through the top, and it will actually scan negatives. I can do different film, 35 millimeter,
the larger frame negatives, whether they're black or white or color. And it does all that. Plus, obviously it's a document scanner as well, but it does specifically perfect output for photographs and slides and negatives. So
I was asking
whether.
Yeah, I have a Canon flatbed professional scanner that has the same kind of frame that you're talking about that Bert is showing. It was coming. This came up in the context of the negatives that Gary uncovered a couple of weeks ago related to the conference. And those frames are those very old 70s vintage Kodak cartridge films. Mm-hmm. So the frames are slightly bigger than a 16 millimeter film frame. And the frames that the physical frames that you get for modern scanners don't hold those, but you could easily improvise. So I was just curious what you were going to do. I have a 9600 DPI scanner and it does reasonably well with negatives, and I use ViewScan software and so forth. So thank you for clarifying it. I appreciate it. I was anxious to capture Gary's films, and he had mentioned that he was sending them off to you. So it sounds great.
I'm actually planning on going down to Gary's. I'm hopefully it'll be me and Brian going down there. Looks like probably end of July, if not sooner. And what I will definitely, like I say, I've done a lot of scans on his things already. But once I get down there and look at more, if he's got more negatives or actual slides in the cardboard, outer edges. My machine does that. The resolution that mine goes up to is you can go from 6400 by 9600 DPI, 17 by 22 as far as lengthwise. But when I went into looking at the, I like the idea of the DPI, but I wanted to look at how much the bit, how many bits you could put into the photograph. And I tried different ones, and the ones that looked out the best is like what I've got on the website at 48 bit color. The black and white scans that he had, well, actually they weren't scans, they were black and white 35 millimeter negatives. And I said, well, let me play with that for a minute. So about 10 minutes later, I was able to reproduce it digitally, and it looked better than what the prints that he already had made. It's got a software package that, for correction of for color sharpness and so on. I mean, I just couldn't believe what the hell it could do, but I was glad I spent the $300 and bought the machine. So I know I took a bunch of negatives down to a place in Dallas, and I said, here, can you scan these for me? And she was using the exact same scanner, and I said, where did you get that at? She goes, well, this is what all the shops. She goes, if you go to any of the shops down here in Texas, she goes, they've all got this machine. And I said, okay. As soon as I saw that and I looked at how much I paid her to scan, I think it was like 20 slides, I told Brian, I said, we're the hell with going and having to stand there and wait for it to be done. They did great work, but I said, let's just buy one and we can take it wherever we go. So obviously, as a techie guy and technology-wise, I like playing with new toys, and that was, any of my Epson stuff I've got, I love it.
If you want to take the technology another order of magnitude higher, the kinds of scanners that we're all familiar with that are in the consumer or prosumer price range are simple light source to a photo optical array of pixels, and that's how you get dots per inch. But the top end scanners are called flying spot scanners, and they go into the thousands of pixels per inch.
Right.
But I was going to quickly look, and you can take a look around, but I suspect that they're in the many thousands of dollars. But they're used by the professionals, particularly in the film and media industry, for capturing those things. So you imagine a standard 2x2 slide, you capture it with a flying spot scanner, and you're going to get a 6,000 or 7,000 pixel wide by corresponding height. And they make them now, or you can just put a stack of slides right into a feeder. So that's the slide version of what Bert's talking about with respect to a document feeder. In general, slides are a little bit more physically predictable in the sense that they tend to just warp a little, but not necessarily fold or crinkle or whatever. So there's a lot out there that can be used.
But my scanner is a Nikon. It's called an LS9000. And I bought it 18 years ago. And on eBay, at this moment, they fetch the same price on what they cost almost 20 years ago because they're so good. They're absolutely mind-blowing. The quality of it, if I do a 120 frame, it'll be half a gig big. It'll be 500 megs at least. And the color, 35 mil, will probably become about 16 bits. On 8 bits, it'll be 60 megs. And on 16 bits, it will be 120 megs. Black and white goes between 20 and 40. So, and they're just really rich. The beauty of the scanner is that, especially with analog material, is that it captures more than any printer will be able to capture on paper, on our C-type prints, what they're called in professional jargon. The scan itself will have a much better quality and more depth and detail than any other print that would be manually created as such. So for that, this scanner is absolutely wonderful to create absolutely mind-blowing quality images as such. And you can even do a super fine scan and all this malarkey, basically, what you can add on as such. It's just great. I'm trying to – I've got some things that were given to me through – Malcolm on Harry Livingston had some slides. He had really good copies of Jack White's backyard photo on Kodachrome slides. So I scanned those in, and they were 150 megs each, basically from size. So they're pretty large, and they have a lot of detail in them, more than so, yeah.
Yeah, that's certainly a significant consideration when you think about the increase in resolution and quality you get, more than corresponding increase in requirement for storage.
Yeah. The thing is also, I got the scanner purely for professional reasons, but I also got it. The other thing was that I was so pissed off, especially like back 15, 20 years ago, pictures on the net were tiny, you know, they couldn't handle it. And all this stuff that is now really normal to have, it just didn't exist. So I basically had to downsize all these images, you know, to this as such. But I tell you one thing, what you have to do is when you make your scans and all your DPIs and this, that, and the other, you should just, when you put them on the web, you should just reduce it, because otherwise it's way too big to upload, and also when people start clicking on them, your bandwidth is just basically getting marauded by large images, and it just cranks your bandwidth up, and of course you may go over your allotted amount of web traffic as such. So
even the best computer monitors don't have the resolution to display.
No, 96 the best. 96
right, so
the best.
Your advice is well taken, Bart.
Thank you. No, you're welcome. And also, the thing is, like, because you are 72 or 96, and unless you have a high-res screen, which only photographers, people in media, or traders, bank traders, stock traders have as such. They have a high-resolution screen, and for that purpose, it would be good. But other than that, yeah, you're just going way overboard. But the good thing is, I would store the full res somewhere else, yeah, because if someone says, listen, I want to check this element of that picture and this detail, then at least you can, because you've got the size for it and the resolution. And for that, for a research point of view, that's just fantastic. You know?
Yeah. One thing I liked that I noticed when I was working with Gary's, he had a, I don't remember which slides they were, but it might have been the Tina Towner slides. I know there's only four of them. And they were so pink because the emulsion layer had just deteriorated over the years. And one of the things about doing it through the scanner, it's got an option to digitally put the emulsion layer back onto the negative or back onto the slide. And I'm just sitting there going, okay, how the hell is that going to look? Well, it went from pink, like looked like somebody had just drizzled Pepto-Bismol and wiped it across the slide. And then when the slide actually came out and you could see it, it looked like it was just taken yesterday.
Right.
And I was really surprised that the software had that ability in the software suite that came with the Epson. That's one of the things that, you know, I looked at what it could do and did a lot of testing with, you know, different
different photo scanners like that and things that could do negatives and slides. And I was sold on it. I mean, I know the Nikon one that you've got because I used one of those when I used to work in film labs and doing video production. So yeah, I know which one, I know. And the one you've got, yeah, you're right. It's one of those things where even if you look up on eBay and try to buy one, they still command their price because they still are, you know, yeah, I know. I've had use of one and I liked it all to hell, but unfortunately I didn't have that kind of money to put out, but I wanted something that could do justice to the archives that we're getting a hold of. So yeah, great information.
Yeah. Hey, David, if you're interested, and I don't want to imply that anybody has any money to spend a lot of the stuff, but I've been using a piece of very sophisticated software from a company called Skylum, Skylum, and it's called Luminar. They've had conventional Luminar, but now they have a version that's called Luminar AI, obviously artificial intelligence. And it does remarkable things with photographs as long as it's understood that it does remarkable things with photographs, right? So from an artistic point of view, and you are a photojournalist or an outdoor photographer, those, you know, poetic license type decisions that you make will be not questioned. So this is powerful software, but it has, you know, steps that you take to modify slides, films, and so forth, but have to be reasonable from a research and archive point of view. And it's very inexpensive software. And I will tell you that Luminar AI does require like an Intel i5 or greater type of processor, but Luminar 4, I think you can get it for $49. I've had them for years, and excellent processing software. It's not scanning software. I use ViewScan for that. But, and if you want any more information about Luminar, just reach out to me.
Yeah, absolutely, Bob. While I've got the floor here for a quick sec, I do want to throw a special shout out to Craig Bozarth. Last week, he was flying, last week he was flying, and he decided to have a stop in Kansas City and come out and have dinner with me and Brian and Casey at a local restaurant. And we were able to sit down for, I'd probably say about an hour and a half and had a great discussion. And it was very nice meeting him in person and getting, you know, we see him at the conferences online here and on our monthly meetings. But if anybody's interested that, hey, want to come out and, you know, swing by our neck of the woods and do dinner with us, hell yeah, we'd love to have you. So I want to say publicly thanks to Craig Bozarth for coming out and doing dinner with us. So
thanks, Craig. Appreciate it.
So are you now finished with Gary Shaw's archive?
No, we have barely scratched the surface. I mean, we have quite a bit of stuff, but he's got a little house in the backyard that is, you know, just full of treasures. And I know that I would love to be able to do the entire collection, but I know
you are going to do the entire thing.
I think that's the way we want to go with that. So definitely it's something that we're doing as we get a chance to, you know, because we don't usually bring anything home with us. You know, we're actually doing, we go down there in person and do everything at his house and stay. I know that I've been working on looking at his archive of audio conversations from cassette tapes and digitizing those, and I'm looking at doing some video cassette that he has as well, plus photographs and documents. So, yeah, he's definitely a plethora of information and an archive to, you know, to treasure.
I did it with Harry's. I did, and Malcolm's. I did about 300 video tapes, and I did about 325 audio recordings of Harry Livingston doing interviews and all this stuff, especially all the medical people and all that. But that's going to be released next year, I think.
Oh, so it's not online yet? The Harry stuff isn't online yet?
Well, it is online, but it's not accessible yet. And there's a very good reason for that. So, but probably because it's going to be part of my next project. So, and but when it comes down, it will be flooded. Everybody will go.
He's one of the researchers that I've been eager to get his look at his files.
Well, soon you will see some of it. I have to say, Harry was more organized than Malcolm, but well, the good thing about was that he made multiple copies of things and then just had, I don't know, a folder on Berkeley or maybe Paul Rothermel or whatever, and it was all in one folder. And so I just had to call the PDF Paul Rothermel and just bang 150-odd pages out. But then I'd come into another folder, and then, of course, particular passages from books that he'd already put, like, say, in a Rothermel folder, and then all of a sudden you see in someone else, Dallas-related, Hunt, maybe, H.L. Hunt, and they also had the same pages in there. So he was quite organized in that way that he sometimes made three copies of four or five pages from a book, but then put them also in those three folders. So whatever was related to that particular person, it made duplicates as such.
Bart, it's driving me crazy. Those two pieces of paper behind your head that seem like they're stuck, what is...
Those are my bills. Don't fuck with my bills. Unless you want to pay them, I don't want to know about it. All right? So...
I'll tell you, Bart and Larry, when you give up your day jobs, you definitely are a comedy troupe, comedy duo. Larry, you can be the straight man. You can be the bud to Bart's Costello.
But yeah, so there's a fair amount of that stuff. I did Ian Grick's archive as well. There are bits on the DPUK website. That's dealeyplazauk.com. There's some bits on there that you can look at. And the same goes for Malcolm's stuff. Some of Malcolm's stuff is available there. I put it online, that page, I don't know, a year or so ago, and then left it for what it was. And I was still growing the collection, not just by scanning it, but also by creating folders where all the stuff went into. Because I didn't have a clue what it all entailed, basically, that was in that archive. I've only, like, in the last, I don't know, 6-9 months, basically, got a feel of how it was organized and how it was put together, et cetera, and what leads to what and who's who and in what way of communication or correspondence they are with each other and such. So, but, yeah, no, it's just different, but it's good. And Harry is just mental because he was an obsessive note taker as well. That's another thing you just have to know. He has these little notes. They're about this big, and then he puts scribbles on there. And then before you know it, you open the folder, and all these little scraps of paper, all fall out. So he was an obsessive note taker. And I also know from Malcolm that you get up really early, and then started making notes and typing stuff out. And with the phone calls as well, you can just hear on one tape, you just hear him breathing loud in the phone. And he just does 3 or 4 phone calls in a row. So that just the tape of 120 minutes is just running, and he just goes on it basically. You can just hear him hang up and then dialing the next person as such. So.
Are the notes legible? Are they fairly legible?
The notes?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's not that difficult. Today I found another document regarding the Tippett murder, and that was handwritten as well. And the bottom of it was just, I tried to enhance it, but it's very, very difficult to enhance it and make it readable as such. But I got 80% of it out of it as such. It wasn't a shocking revelation, the document, but it's just kind of nice to see, especially the handwritten stuff as such. Yeah. So... That's that.
Well, I think we've had a lot of great information shared today, and I think I want to go ahead and bring this to a close for this week. But I want to make some quick announcements. Number one, I want to thank Larry and Bart, Larry Rivera, Bob Saltzman, Bill Simpage, everybody that joined in today and helped make our meeting a success. I also want to let everybody know to please go to projectjfk.com, click on the events tab, and get your free e-ticket for Dr. Newman's presentation. It's going to be on June 23rd from 6 to 9 p.m. Central Standard Time that Wednesday evening. It's going to be, I think it's going to be incredible information. I know the way that show is going to run, it's going to be the first 60 minutes. Well, there's going to be an introduction. There'll be a 60 minutes of pre-recorded that Dr. Newman has done. And then we're going to break for 30 minutes of live Q&A with Dr. Newman, kind of like a little intermission. Then we're going to come back, play the last hour. Now, the way that we're going to play the last hour, then we're going to go live again for another 30 minutes of Q&A. The way he's done this is it's basically six different sections that he's put in order. And instead of having to hold and wait for your questions to be answered at the very end and maybe forget, or everybody tries to jump in at once, we're going to do two Q&A sessions during that evening. And definitely, by all means, please sign up for your e-tickets. And if you know of anybody that is not familiar with our website, please give them the information, because I want to make sure that there's a large audience for Dr. Newman to have. And I think his material is always highly anticipated for his research that he does and the work that he does. So I want to have a large gathering of researchers and people to see what he's speaking of. And, you know, like I say, it's a preview to his upcoming book, Armageddon. So I know that there'll be some more information. There'll be several emails over the next 2 weeks that'll probably go out. So if you sign up for your ticket and you get an email, hey, I just want to make sure everybody gets missed so that everybody gets the same information. But definitely want to throw that out there. And please be sure to check later on within the next week for our next journey meeting that is our normal one that we do. It'll be happening in July. Because of the holiday of July 4th, I don't know exactly what day just yet of when we're going to be able to get together, but we are getting together, and we're going to do our regular meeting, and then I'm going to try to line up a researcher that I want. I've got a few in mind, and I want to figure out which one that I want to showcase next month. After talking to Brian and Casey, what my plan is this. We're gonna be doing our normal November conference, just like we do every year. Usually the weekend before everybody does theirs down in Dallas. So we kind of get a chance. You get a chance to see from our group first before the other ones the following weekend. But that's the one that everybody, you know, pays their price to get into. But during the year, you get 12 journey meetings every month for free, and then you get 11 researchers' presentations each year, and one a month. So those are also free. So the only time that you actually have to pay for a conference is just during the November month for the annual conference that we do. So with support of people like Larry Snaff, Brooks LaPlante, anybody that wants to make a donation to the group to continue doing what we're doing with archiving documents, archiving the silos of information, you can always click on the donate button on the homepage and pay through PayPal. It can be a one-time donation. You can set something up if you'd like to do a regular donation more than once. You know, we're not a 501c3 nonprofit, but we do take the money and we use it for buying equipment, continue doing the show each month, you know, twice a month, and continue bringing something where we all get a chance to come together and share the information of the research community. And we're actually making this a community instead of what, you know, the community was kind of like what it was before the last 3 years that we've done the website, and now we're, you know, expanding into new ways of being able to, you know, have a forum to come together. So if anybody would like to, you know, support us in the work that we're doing, the continued work that we want to do, that's the way that you can do that. And again, I want to thank everybody that has, you know, has attended with us. And, you know, we love having our regulars. And without you guys and without everybody, we wouldn't have a meeting that we do. And another thing, anybody that I know, we have some people that, that show up and they listen and they participate that way, and that's great. And don't think for one instance that you can't, you know, turn on your microphone or send out a chat to ask a question or to be part of it. Everybody is welcome. There's no stifling of free speech here. We do ask everybody to be polite and courteous with each other. Not always do we have the same ideas, but you know what? We're all in the same path of trying to find out exactly what the hell took place in our history, and on particular on the day of November 22nd, 1963. So with that, if anybody else, you know, wants to say anything in closing, I think we're going to wrap this up, and we'll see everybody again on the 23rd. And then we're going to
thanks, Mark.
We're going to do our next meeting in the month of July, and then we'll have our next representative, our next presentation by our next researcher. So with that, if anybody else has anything to say.
Can I just say one? If you need a speaker for November on the Malcolm Blunt archive, which I haven't done before, then I'm more than willing to do that if you want me. And there was a second thing and I've not completely flown this. But, oh, and can I have a quick word with you? Because I need to pick your brain about a couple of things. So if we can do that on a private call or via email, then, yeah, whichever way.
Yeah, I tell you what I'll do. Once we wrap the meeting up, give me about 30 minutes and I'll call you through the WhatsApp app. And then we can talk about it, Bart.
Okay. Oh, cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, no, could I make a suggestion for a future topic?
Sure, go ahead.
Which is simply, I've been seeing widely available interviews with a guy who wrote a book, Kennedy's Avenger. I think he's linked to NBC, and he's a legal advisor to NBC. Kennedy's Avenger, and it's about Jack Ruby. And to me, it's revisionist history saying that Jack Ruby is putting him back into wannabe a mobster category, and saying he acted on impulse, and that Oswald's murder was not planned. And I think it would be a good topic for somebody to attack, frankly. He wants to go back to square one with Jack Ruby as if the HSCA never happened.
Okay. Why don't you send me an email with as much information as you can. And let me see what I can do about putting that together as a future topic at one of our meetings.
Dan Abrams wrote the book. He's a legal analyst for
Is it out yet?
NBC, maybe.
Yeah, and it's about the Ruby trial. There's a better book on the Ruby trial. It was written in 1965 by a judge, if anyone wants it. But this is Dan Abrams. You know, he's mainstream media, so.
Can we not combine this with, say, get Gary Shaw involved as well and to have him talk about Ruby as well and just get like two or three heavy hitters together and then bring Ruby on the board? I think that would be really good. There would be a good discussion going on.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
By the way, the lawyer that defended Ruby died this past week. He's a California. What was his?
Tannehill.
Larry Ray Harris isn't around anymore. He did a lot of work on Ruby.
Yeah, one of our English guys as well, Stuart Galloway. I've sent him all my documentation, and I've sent Gary as well all my documentation, and he came back to me and said that several documents were new to him as such, so which is always a good thing.
This is a really good book, written in 65. This is a classic, a classic study of courtroom strategies. So it's by Kaplan and Waltz, which are very known at that time. Effley Bailey. Wasn't it Effley Bailey that represented him?
Yes, Effley Bailey.
He died this past week.
Wow. I don't know that he represented Jack Ruby, though. Bailey, I'm not sure I'm not sure Bailey represented Jack Ruby.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Melvin Belli. Yeah, like Henry Wages used to say it all the time.
Yeah.
Melvin Belli.
This shows you what a cluster F this whole trial was. It was, you know, it just was poor strategy on the part of Melvin Belli. Anyway,
poor strategy in the sense that, let's say, Sirhan had poor strategy.
Yeah.
It may have been as crazy as the fox. Well, let me put it this way. When I was in Villai's office in San Francisco some years ago, he had a picture of him on the wall outside the conference room where I was attending a deposition, and it was a picture of him and Mickey Cohen.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, if I had been in charge of this trial, I would have taken a whole different approach than, you know, he didn't really examine that whole issue. It was all about claiming he was insane, basically.
He never had a chance.
No. Right.
Ruby never had a chance.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
That's some very good food for thought, guys.
Yeah, so maybe the JFK Project could put together a Jack Ruby presentation, so to speak.
Yeah, because it's really important to refute this.
Yeah.
Just like, what's the CIA guy, Patrick, that had the book out recently? Woolsey?
Yeah, Woolsey.
Yes.
Yeah. They're coming up with these crazy, they're trying to resurrect things, and it's really important for us to be.
And I think it's deliberately timed to coincide with the, withholding documents and so forth.
Yeah. They're going to come back and say, hey, you know what? Yeah, we hid these, but we were being patriots. We were saving the country from World War III.
Nothing to see here, folks.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
All right. Over behind the curtain. Thank you.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to close this meeting, and we will see everybody, on the 23rd, and keep checking the website for updates.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks
a lot. All right. Good weekend.
All right.